All right, everybody, it's Mike, and this is Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. I'll be back with you all in just a few minutes, and we'll play a piece of music, here, and come back and do the show. Once again, it's Mike Hagan, Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Welcome to the radio program tonight, everybody. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit, and it's a pleasure to be here with you all, as it is every Monday night. We do this from 11 p.m. until 2 a.m. in the morning, and it's a pleasure to do it again with you all tonight, okay? Thanks to listening and supporting KOPN, community radio here in mid-Missouri and worldwide. I'll be with you for the next 3 hours, okay? And we've got a wonderful program lined up for you this evening. We have my good friend John Major Jenkins, who will be in the studio with me here in just a few minutes. He's actually here at the station, and we've been hanging out for the last few hours. And we'll talk with John about 2012 and the Maya and who knows what else. That in just a little bit here. Stick around and fasten up, okay? Before all of that, a big thank you, as always, to Corey, my friend, Corey Flaker. Thank you, my dear. Corey does it up every week, New Wave Radio Theater. What was your program tonight?
It was another fourth.
You always picked a different mic. Well, now I'm going to turn them all on, all right?
They're all.
There. What was the program tonight?
The Fourth Tower of Inverness, which is that Jack Flanders series that I'm playing right now.
That was Jack Flanders was the character that was in the Morocco series, right?
Yeah.
Moon Over Morocco. That was cool.
Yeah, and if you listen, you can tell that it's a similar theme and similar sound effects, and it's pretty cool.
And the comedy sort of same.
Similar comedy. Characters kind of have the similar strangeness to them.
Yes, as we all do. All right, Corey, you're awesome. Thanks. I'll see you next week. What are you doing next week? Got anything planned?
Same thing. I think it's a 7-week series.
Uh-huh.
It's an 8-week series.
8-week series.
So.
We're in week 4 or something like that.
This is week 3.
Week 3.
So we've got a while. Yeah.
All right.
5 more weeks.
Okay. We'll be listening.
Okay.
Take care.
A good show.
All right. Thanks. Bye. Okay. Jack Flanders. More of it next week. Okay. Every week before this program, Corey brings you the wonderful theater on the radio. KOPN, New Wave Radio Theater. Thanks to Corey for doing that. Before her, Kelvin and Eric the Red. Jazz plus blues equals out of this world. Tech Radio does it from 6 to 7, keeping us up on the extremely weird world of high technology. And Jeff Wheeler starts things off with Uncommon Light, 3 to 5 p.m. every Monday. Good music, good talk, good news. A radio revolution here on your imagination station, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. You're listening to it, and it's a pleasure to be a part of it with y'all, okay? All right, thanks to everybody who joined in with us last week on the program. And a big thank you, of course, to Brooke Medicine Eagle. Wonderful, wonderful woman who I'm so pleased to be able to have been able to bring to you last week. Brooke and I have been in touch for some time, and it was great to be able to have her on the show. We'll do another program with Brooke probably sometime in the summertime, and we will include her partner, Sonny, in the conversation next time, okay? So, Brooke, wonderful stuff. Thank you so much for being on the program. I appreciate it, and I can't wait to talk with you again sometime later in the year. The music was provided last week by the same person, Brooke Medicine Eagle. Wonderful stuff that she provided for us from a CD that was called Gathering the Sacred Breath. Brooke Medicine Eagle, just a wonderful woman, and if you are unfamiliar with her, I would suggest that you might take a listen to the program last week and check out her website at medicineeagle.com. And you never know what you might run across, okay? Okay. So thanks to Brooke for the music and for the talk, okay? By the way, all the music that's featured on the program can be found on my website over there in the Music Archives section. You just got to click over to Music Archives, and you can get a look at and a listen to many of the talented and gifted singers and songwriters and instrument players that appear on the program every week. We do independent music and provide it for you free of all charge, and we will continue to do that as long as we possibly can. Tonight, the music that we're going to be listening to, if I can get my act together, is from my friend Bartholomew Bean. I have a CD of his that is now stuck in CD Player 2, and I cannot get at it. So that's why I started things off with Monkey Underneath from Ism. But if Bart can get me some different discs, we'll continue with some of his music throughout the program. And he's a local and regional singer-songwriter, performer, musician, artist, and a friend of mine who's just doing wonderful work all around this area, and I'm pleased to be able to share some of Bart's music with y'all tonight, okay? Okay, John Major Jenkins. He is an author and a writer and a speaker and somebody who has a tremendous amount of knowledge with regard to the ancient Maya, their culture, their mythology, their cosmology, their worldview, and their calendar. We've had John on the program at least 2 times, maybe 3, over the last year and a half, 2 years or so, and it's going to be a great experience tonight because John is actually here in Columbia, Missouri, and had some business to attend to not far from here, and we thought it would be great if he could just hang around for a couple days, which he decided to do, and we'll be able to do this live radio program, and then tomorrow night we have something special to tell you about too, but I'll get to that in just a little bit here, okay? I think what I will do is play another piece of music and give me a chance to get my act together. I was sort of in a rush here when I got into the studio because it is pledge drive week here at KOPN, and that means that we're looking for folks like you to show your appreciation for the radio program and for the radio station in general. And if you'd like to do that, you can donate some of your hard-earned money to keep us on the air. The best way to do that is to email me at orbitradio, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, orbitradio@AOL.com. Just send me a note, and then I'll tell you, you know, actually, the only reason I say not to call now is because there's nobody here to answer the phones. This time of night, I'm usually on my own, so if you call the pledge, I won't be able to answer the phone, so I ask people just to send an email, and then I'll get back to you and give you the contact information and the phone number where you can call and make a pledge. We used to be able to do this over the website, the KOPN.org website, but right now the donation function of the website is not currently operational, so you'll have to do it via a phone call, and you'll have to do it sometime other than tonight. So call me, you can call during a break, you know, if I'm on a break, and there's music playing, I'd be glad to answer the phone. But the number here is 573-874-5676, 573-874-5676, if you'd like to let us know that you appreciate what we're doing over here at KOPN, okay? All right, let's play a piece of music here from Bartholomew Bean, and then we will come back. I got a couple quick things to take care of, and we'll speak with John Major Jenkins then for the rest of the program, okay? It's going to be a great time tonight. Stick around. Glad to be here with you, and thanks to everyone for listening. Back in just a minute, it's Mike. You're listening to KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. This is Radio Orbit.
Upon bejeweled and blinking blades of green, the horizon. horizon shimmers with light so brightly yellow and serene. A breath to stir a breeze cast from a gaseous sea, and the words then whisper beside a sacred story said to me.
Bartholomew Bean. Wonderful piece of music there that I don't even know the name of. What's that called, Bean?
Song of the Sun Gods.
Song of the Sun Gods. Appropriate for our conversation tonight, I think. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's about 20 minutes after the hour of 11 p.m. now on the 18th of February, 2008. Rolling right along here. Praying for spring like you can't imagine. And we've got a full moon just around the corner, what they call a waxing gibbous right now, but it'll be full tomorrow night. And at the same time, we have a lunar eclipse tomorrow night, too. So the 19th, tomorrow should be a good night to get outside, take a look up at the sky and the stars up there and the moon. Beautiful stuff if you can stay warm, okay? Hello to everybody out there listening on KOPN over the traditional airwaves or otherwise over the Internet. Every Monday, we do the program here from the wonderful studios at KOPN in downtown Columbia, Missouri, right here on Broadway. We stream the show as well on the web at kopn.org. Just click on the Listen Live button, and you'll get a nice 64K stream coming at you from anywhere on the planet, as long as you have a decent Internet connection, okay? All right, thanks as well to all the people out there who are sending art and music and poetry. Wonderful stuff in the Poets Corner right now. And I love it. Send more. If you're an artist of any site, of any sort, please feel free to share your art with me, and I'll do my best to find a place for it on the website and share it with other people, okay? You can see what I'm talking about if you do exactly that. Get on the web and point your mouse over to Mike Hagan, H-A-G-A-N, www.thesungodsradio.com. You'll have access to everything that I'm doing. No passwords required, no registration, no money, none of that stuff. Just zip on over there and see what you like, okay? We have an interesting forum, a bulletin board that's always active and interesting topics being discussed and talked about amongst different people. There is a live chat room that is up and active right now, but also active anytime you decide to make it active. So all this stuff is available through the website, and you can check it out once again at MikeHagan.com, all right? Thanks to everybody over there in the chat room, by the way. Hello. And we'll peek in there as we move through the program tonight and see if you guys have anything to add, if you have any questions or comments for John, and do our best to get at that stuff, okay? I always encourage all of my guests as well as listeners to join us in the chat room and the forum. It's a great way to communicate and correspond with like-minded or otherwise individuals, okay? All right, my email address, orbitradio, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, orbitradio@AOL.com. Send me email. I love to hear from y'all. So do the guests and musicians that appear on the program. We're all interested in feedback. Just try to be kind, all right? And we'll do our best to get back to you, I'm sure. The phone number here, for those interested, 573-874-5676. When we do music breaks, you're free to call and talk it up, okay? And I don't know, maybe we'll take some phone calls with John a little bit later. We'll have to see. We got a couple people in the studio with us as well tonight, so I'm sure we'll have plenty of questions throughout the program. But either way, call, put something up on the chat, send me email, whatever. I'll try to get to it, okay? All right, a couple quick things before we get to John. Let me tell you what's happening over the next few weeks. Next week, Richard Allen Miller, back by popular demand. Richard is very popular here on the program, and we're going to do a program on magic and alchemy. And it's a topic that Richard can address and one that we haven't spoken much about on the air in the past. So Richard Allen Miller, next week, magic and alchemy. I hope you can join me for that, okay? Tonight, of course, as I mentioned, John Major Jenkins here in the studio with me, along with a few other friends, and going to be a blast. We got Graham Hancock in the wing sometime later this year, David Abram, Glenn Kimball, Dan Winter. A lot of people have been asking me to get Dan Winter on the air, and that'll happen on March 11th. I spoke with Dennis McKenna and John Sheliak today. We're going to do a show probably in June, I'm thinking, with Dr. McKenna and Dr. Sheliak. That should be one for the archives for sure. A lot of people had asked if we could get those two guys together, and interestingly, they were both up for it. So Dr. John Sheliak and Dr. Dennis McKenna, probably in June. And, well, I'm not sure between now and then what else we'll have, but I've got a lot of interesting people that sort of in the wing just haven't been confirmed, including Harvey Antleman, Rabbi Harvey Antleman, the guy who holds the patent for this HIV cure that I've been talking about for the last who knows how long. And everybody says, well, does it work? And I say, well, if you want to find out if it works, we should request clinical trials of it. Sounds like a reasonable proposal to me. So anyway, Harvey Antleman, hopefully we can get him on the air. He's very difficult to get a hold of, and for probably good reason, but I'll do my best to see if I can get him to talk with us about this stuff, okay? Anyway, lots more in the wing, and I'll do my best to, you know, provide some great stuff for you over the course of the year here. 2008, now a couple months into it, and, you know, just hot and heavy as it just seems to keep getting more and more so. The world around us, more and more interesting every day as far as I'm concerned. And it's just a thrill and at the same time sort of a freak show to be a part of it. But certainly not much we can do about it other than hang on and hang in, sort of. So that's what I plan on doing. That's what I've had to do all winter. I've been under the weather. I'm still sort of that way tonight, a little bit better than last week, actually. But, you know, I'm just moving along like everybody else, doing the best I can with what I got, okay? I hope you guys are doing the same. Once again, it is pledge drive time here at KOPN, so if you are interested in supporting this radio program and the radio station, please send me an email, orbitradio@AOL.com, and I can let you know how you can help us out, okay? Okay. Space weather, we will sort of take a break on space weather until next week. And, well, other things that we may talk about later in the program, we'll just get to them if we do. But I think first and foremost, we should take the time that we have with our in-studio guests and get right to them. Say hello to John Major Jenkins, my friend. John, how are you?
I'm doing well, Mike. I'm so excited to be here.
It is a thrill to have you here and be able to look at you right in the eye while we're talking about all this stuff. It's great. We've done a couple of programs, of course, over the last couple of years. And those shows are, you know, I look at the downloads and I can tell who, which ones are getting downloaded the most and that sort of stuff. You, a guy named Paul Laffoley, Dennis McKenna, and this guy, Richard Allen Miller, are the four top downloads of over the course of this program over all these years.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're someone who is certainly appreciated by my listeners, and I know that they'll be excited to hear you talk again tonight. So before we get too deeply into it, what the hell are you doing here? People are going to say, why are you in the studio there with Mike? I think most people who are paying attention know that you live out there in Colorado.
Well, I'm doing a cross-country road trip, more or less, and thought I'd drop by the studios here and hang out with my buddy Mike.
I'm going to tell people what you were doing. You bought a couple of printing presses, actually.
Printing presses, yes, indeed.
This like old-school printing
presses. Old-school printing presses, yes. This is my new thing, you might say. And I get interested in these various sort of arcane pursuits. And letterpress printing is something that's been around for a long time. It's the way that books were printed back in the 1800s and before offset printing and all that. And I've become intrigued in it with it. And what I've sort of been looking at is I'd like to produce some limited edition high quality books and booklets and broadsides, poetry broadsides. Poetry has always been really close to my heart, and sometimes I think that poetry and music is a way that we can express truths and beauty that is much more moving and profound than, nonfiction research.
Yeah,
we can really get to those things.
Yeah, I didn't know that you were a poetry writer until I spent some time with you last year, actually, when my son and I visited you for a short period of time in Colorado, and you gave me a copy of some of your poetry, and I'd actually perhaps be interested if you have any of it with you. Maybe you'd like to read something later. I don't know.
Yeah, I did bring some stuff.
Okay.
I'll have to explain it, sort of the, give the background on this. It's kind of an interesting story.
Well, maybe a little bit further in the program, we'll do that. Okay.
Yeah, and what I'll do too is this has been sort of exciting because I grew up in Chicago actually, so the Midwest is familiar to me and. I do live in Colorado. I've been out in Colorado for 22 years, but I
didn't know you grew up in Chicago. I did too.
Really?
I was born in Rockford, Illinois.
Okay, yeah, western suburbs.
Yeah.
Elmhurst.
Yeah, a little bit further than that.
Yeah, yeah.
Were you actually a city boy? Were you born in Chicago?
No, western suburbs.
Suburbs.
Yeah.
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 Schaumburg or Hoffman Estates or something like that?
Out west, that way, like Wheaton.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I know.
Lombard, Elmhurst, those places, yeah.
Well, interesting. Yep, that's my old stomping ground as well. I'm sure we'll digress plenty tonight, so I'm not going to worry about it. You know, I went to NIU, Northern Illinois University, for two and a half years, where this crazy guy, got all excited and shot a bunch of people a few days ago. Yeah.
I used to ride my bicycle quite a bit. I was really into that, and there's a path that runs along the old abandoned railroad track west out of Chicago and goes through the western suburbs. And it ends in DeKalb.
Huh.
And that was always sort of the gold standard. That was always the destination. It was a good 110-mile round trip.
Wow.
And I did that a couple of times because the path would go all the way out there.
Huh. Cool.
And,
all right. So so that's right. John's in town here sort of on a little road trip. He went and picked up a couple of printing presses. And now
I'll type in the – I have a lot of – pages that I posted on my website that are just sort of like free-floating. They're not really connected. I put them up there for the purpose of showing somebody something. And so I've got like a freestanding web page. I'll type in the address for that into the chat room, and people can go look at the printing presses. One of them's an old-style Gordon press that's about 115 years old. This is the old-style, you know, printing press with a flywheel and a foot treadle.
You have to set the text and
all
that.
Yeah, and you hand set the type, and it's. I think of it as a meditation, it's a return to printing as a human-powered endeavor. It's not about mass production and huge sales with trade paperbacks going out to a million people. That's not the goal. The goal is to produce limited editions of high-quality, well-designed artistic productions.
Cool, cool.
So,
and you're going to set those up, or at least one of them at your
place? Yeah, you know, in my garage, basically. I'm sort of turning it into a letterpress book arts studio.
How cool. I love it.
It'll be fun, yeah.
Well, it's got to be difficult. Imagine what it used to take to print, you know, a newspaper or whatever every day. That just
blows
me
away.
All
little,
by hand.
Little hand-type things that they'd put in with spacers and... Yeah, massive enterprise.
Yeah, now I know why you say it can be considered a meditation of sorts, because it's meticulous work.
Yes.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. Okay, well, the reason that most of the people that listen to this program would like to hear you talk has probably very little to do with printing presses. What was it Terrence said, that you're sort of remembered by your first idea or your first...
A prophet
major
is
work, right?
Held victim to his first elucidation or something like
That's
that.
That's right. Yeah. Well, certainly one of your first ones had to do with the ancient Maya, this culture of people that still exists today, but certainly thrived many, many years ago. And they're a mysterious folk, for sure. And looking back at their culture from the future as we are, there are many questions and mysteries about what they were doing and what they were thinking and why they were doing what they were doing and how they were so adept at it. And I think for me, the more I've gotten to know about this, the more fascinated I am by it. The more I learn, the more amazed I am, actually, with what these people were able to achieve, essentially with what we assume is little or no quote-unquote technology, you know? So tonight, that's what we'll do. We'll talk like we usually do about the Maya, because as we approach this whole 2012 period, more and more people are getting interested, and the waters are getting muddy because people who have had less interest over the years gone by are now getting interested, and a lot of people just want to sort of get a feel for what's happening. So,
yeah.
So let's do that. For the people who are unfamiliar, and there always are a few, I don't want to spend too much time on it because we'll bore the people that are familiar. But for new listeners who haven't heard you speak before and don't know a damn thing about the Maya or 2012 or galactic alignments or this sort of thing, tell them a little bit about what this is and why you're interested in it.
Well, I became interested in the Maya, and there's a great unresolved question around this cycle-ending date. And scholars have figured out how the Maya calendar works with our own calendar. So we basically have the information that this great cycle of time ends on December 21st of 2012, this period of some 5,125 years. It's a great cycle. It's part of this Mayan idea of world ages. Many different traditions share this idea that humanity passes through distinct chapters in, you know, the evolutionary journey, one might say. And it's been a great enigma as to why the Maya picked December 21st, 2012 to end this great cycle of time. A lot of scholars have just dismissed it. It's irrelevant.
Right.
But I looked into this question and asked the right questions. For example, okay, well, where was this long count calendar invented? When?
Right.
You know, and who did it? You know, these questions are answerable. And it set me in a direction of finding answers. And It's really quite fascinating, you know, throughout this whole journey, it also hasn't really just been a question of uncovering facts or even reconstructing the fragments of a lost cosmology. It's been a journey that has helped me understand a very different mind frame. The breakthroughs for me have occurred not simply in uncovering some lost fact, but in actually changing my perceptual assumptions. In a sense...
How do you mean?
Well, I think that there's a lot of cliches and stereotypes that revolve around the Maya, for one. And so those need to be set aside and transcended so that we can be open to appreciating what is a very sophisticated paradigm, a very sophisticated understanding of the world as it really is, not just some relative cultural belief or something like that, but a very deep insight into the, I guess the only way I could really say it is sort of the multidimensional interweaving nature of reality. You know, there's the way that the Maya were able to understand the great comprehensive unity of all life is something that, in order to understand that, it requires that a student or a scholar or somebody who's looking into this needs to be on a journey, a deepening journey that is, you know, in personally engaging, in a sense. One's own perceptual apparatus, one might say, has to go through a transformation in order to actually perceive the truths that the Maya perceived. And they are truths. They're not just culturally relative beliefs.
Let me ask you about the date, just to clarify. The Maya didn't use a Gregorian calendar. They had their own system of measuring time and days and this sort of stuff. In the Gregorian system, we have been able to, through yourself and other people, I'm sure, been able to determine how they translate, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the end of the current cycle corresponds,
yes,
to December 21st, 2012.
Right.
But the Maya, per se, didn't have anything to say about December. They didn't even know the word. Right?
Right, yeah. Yeah, that needs to be clarified sometimes because, yeah, the assumption shouldn't be that they actually had that date inscribed. They had the equivalent date in their own long count calendar, mm-hmm, inscribed.
Okay.
So it's just a way that we can, you know, talk about it and make some sense from the framework that we deal with.
Right, because for the great majority of people in our culture, they deal with the Gregorian calendar, and very few people understand the sophistication of the Mayan calendar to begin with.
Right,
and they can actually keep time on a daily basis that way. This is going to sound strange, but do you use the Mayan calendar as a calendar?
I have in the past. I mean, the 260-day sacred calendar is an interesting oracular kind of framework, somewhat similar to the way that Western astrology, although perhaps Western astrology is connected more directly with the planets and so on, I guess it's probably more analogous to the I Ching, the 64 units of the I Ching, which are said to structure some kind of geomantic unfolding that has repercussions in the physical world as well as the subjective inner world. Mm-hmm. So there's this inner-outer sort of connection that is expressed in the universal numerical structure of the I Ching. So, too, with the 260-day sacred calendar, I've followed it sort of as a curious outsider, and I have noticed that it does tend to structure important life events. For example, I some people follow it as sort of day keepers, and they follow it every day, so they know exactly what day it is every day and what day is coming down the road. So they know that, say, their birthday in the 260-day Dzogchen calendar is going to be next week. So they've got this kind of anticipation. The way that I used to follow it would be not to really follow it on a day-to-day basis. But what I do is, if something kind of strange came up in my life, or if there was a bundle of synchronicity that happened over a couple of days, or maybe some significant thing came to a culmination, like the day that I proposed to my wife, a couple of weeks after that, I thought, wow, man, that was really an incredible period. And, of course, we didn't really have it planned out. You know, it's like, next Tuesday, I'm gonna propose to my... These kind of things kind of come out of our own spiritual unfolding,
right.
You know?
Right.
So it's those kind of things that the 260-day calendar structures. So when I did that and I looked back on that date, I found out to my amazement that it was my birthday in the 260-day calendar.
Uh-huh. Now, I think people probably have a little bit of a difficult time grasping this, because in the Gregorian system, my birthday is on August 15th. Well, it's August 15th every year, but August 15th is a different day every year.
Mm-hmm.
Might be a Monday or a Tuesday or Wednesday. In the Mayan calendrical system, I believe that your birthday would be on the same day every year, right?
It's every 260 days. So it's actually cycling backwards. Every time it occurs 3 months earlier in the solar year.
Huh, very interesting.
Yeah.
But the same sort of the larger scene focuses on it. Now, in other words, I'm not sure
I'm
being clear.
The reason why that is possible is because the 260-day calendar is based upon the nine-month period of human gestation.
Hmm.
Maya daykeepers will offer that as an explanation for why 260 is such a key number. It's that first great cycle of geomantic unfolding that we all experience. And so the idea is that all other key life events will be also unfolding in some kind of resonant relationship with that first. So the day that you're born on, that signifies, you know, that placement, your orientation in sacred time. There might be, you know, 260 relations. There might be 130 relations. You know, something might happen on the day opposite the day you were born.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of a model or a paradigm of resonance and harmonics.
So the idea is that if you watch this over time, you can sort of see patterns maybe come out of it, huh?
And in fact, you'll see patterns in your own inner spiritual life as well as patterns in the outer world. And the reason why is because 260 is a key number. It's based upon, 260 is based upon the golden proportion, which is that magical number in nature which is self-referential. It creates spirals in nature, pine cones, seashells.
Yeah, 1.618.
That's right,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
And 1.618 squared is 2.618.
Huh.
And that's that's sort of a glimpse of why it's self-referential. And 260 shares this magical property of the golden proportion such that it can structure events in the inner world as well as the outer world. The Maya used it, the 260-day calendar, as a framework for predicting astronomical cycles like Venus, morning star rising,
and
eclipses.
And transits and that sort of thing.
And transits and the moon cycle and all that.
We have a couple of things happening. There's a lunar eclipse that's happening tomorrow. There's a Venus transit that I think is going to happen in 2012, right?
Right, right.
Why did they think that these types of celestial events, astronomical events, were significant?
Well,
you know, we look upon it with sort of, cool, it's an eclipse, but we really don't take it much further than that, you know.
Well, they believed that everything's interwoven and everything's interconnected. Things that happen in the sky were believed to be important by the Maya, not by route of the sort of the astrology idea that we think about. You know, most people think that astrology is about the planets affect us or something, or the planets determine our fate or something like that. The Maya had a much more nuanced and sophisticated understanding of these things. It's based on that principle, as above, so below. You know, cycles in the sky reflect cycles on the earth, or the inner world reflects the outer world. But I believe that the Maya understood this by way of resonance. In other words, everything springs from the same source. So the things that we're experiencing in our own inner unfolding here on Earth are reflected in the cycles that we perceive in the planets and the conjunctions and the alignments. It's not really that one's affecting the other in that kind of cause and effect principle of scientism. It's that everything springs from the same source, so everything's unfolding with the same resonant rhythm.
Well, back to the calendars. They have more than one calendar. You mentioned the 260-day calendar, but there's some other ones involved. How many did they have?
Oh, they had lots of different calendars, but they were all integrated in a congruent sort of way. So they weren't in conflict with each other. And also, a lot of times people bring up this idea that, oh, well, the Maya had many different calendars, and they're sort of giving the implication that the Maya are following different day counts. This is a very important thing to understand, because there's been some controversy over what day it is today in the Maya calendar. Mm-hmm. There's been sort of modern writers that are inventing their own day count systems. And so when somebody says, oh, the Maya had many different calendars, it doesn't mean that they had different day counts. There was one universally followed day count system. And when you say that there's many different calendars, yeah, well, they had a moon calendar, and they had a Mars calendar, and they had a 365-day sort of solar calendar called the Hab, and, of course, the 260-day sacred calendar. They also had the long count calendar, which is the thing that, which is the calendar that relates to the 2012 end date. But all of these calendars are sort of integrated and related to each other.
Okay, all right. You just said a word, I forget the name of the 365-day calendar. What'd you call it?
The Hab.
The Hab.
Yeah.
It made me think of another phrase. It's called the Hunab Ku.
Right.
What's that?
Well, Hunab Ku is a Yucatec Maya deity who is often referred to as the one movement, one giver of movement and measure. Modern writers and believe that it refers to the galactic center. It's often designated by a spiral form. Linguistically, it seems to be related to earlier Maya deities. You can trace the linguistic transformation from the very early first father deity in the Popol Vuh. His name's One Hunapu. One in the, you know, the number one in the Maya language is Hun. So Hun Hunapu. Or just Hunapu. H-U-N-A-H-P-U. Hunapu.
Mm-hmm.
And so one can track how this interesting deity, he's the father of the Hero Twins. He's the first father. He's the first solar lord. You can see how it can break down into Hunapu. And then Hunabku, Hunabku, Hunabku. So
yeah, certainly related. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a modern, and in fact, in a different route, it's through this deity name that we get our word Hurricane, Hunrakan. Hunrakan means 1 foot.
Oh, and I think about the spiral.
That's right.
Yeah.
The 1 foot on the pole star spinning around.
Right.
Now the pole star is a cosmic center in the sky, but the galactic center is another cosmic center in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
So this deity seems to be, more generally speaking, a deity of the cosmic center, the cosmic center idea, wherever that might be located, whether it's the polar center or the galactic center.
Okay. All right. So we have a sophisticated calendrical system, and they're interested in the center of the galaxy, it appears, and lots of other things. But let's talk a little bit before we take a break at the top of the hour about why calendars and day keeping and this type of thing were so important to them. In a modern day context, the calendar that we use, and for the most part calendars all around the planet, are used primarily to plan no further than a few weeks ahead, probably, unless you got a big vacation coming up in a year or something. But we don't particularly look at the calendar with any significance other than just sort of a way to manage our really immediate time frame. But the Maya seem to have been interested in time that went way back in their past, and then also a long way forward. In fact, further forward than their culture mm-hmm. even reasonably existed. So why such an interest in calendricals?
Well, I think the main distinction that we have that we sometimes grapple with from our own vantage point is because we're used to just using calendars as a kind of a way to schedule appointments or something like that so that we can be somewhere on time. That's a very secular kind of mundane use of calendars. It comes with an assumption about time, you know, that time is some kind of commodity, you know, that we can manipulate. And our language reveals this, you know, we can save time.
Yeah.
We can run out of time.
Spend time.
We can spend time.
Yeah, they're all economic metaphors.
Yes. Whereas, on the other hand, all traditional cultures, indigenous societies, including the Maya and including the old cultures of Europe, the so-called pagans, they had an approach to time that was much more sacred. More specifically speaking, they did have mundane agricultural calendars that would schedule sort of mundane things, but they also had sacred calendars.
Right.
You know,
right.
They recognized a sacred dimension to time. And I think what's important to understand is that the Maya, they recognized, they had a secular calendar and they also had a sacred calendar, but they placed the sacred calendar on a sort of a higher level, and appropriately so. The sacred dimension embraces the mundane dimension. It can't be the other way around as we have it in the modern world where basically the secular domain is thought to be the supreme place and the sacred has just been winnowed out or turned into some kind of dream or something like that.
Right, or some silliness or something like that. It's not taken nearly as seriously.
Right.
Okay, well then, I think that that's the one that we want to concentrate on then, this idea of time having a sacred dimension to it. Why? What was so sacred?
Well, life is sacred.
Mm.
Precious human birth, as the Buddhists would say, you know. We, are human beings on this planet, I believe, and we're so blessed, you know, to be able to share life and to have this incredible awareness of being alive, you know, and you know, I guess that being a human being on this planet, it's sort of an opportunity, you know, that we can open up to, or we can, you know, sort of deny it or reject it and close down and not really experience what it fully is to be human. And so it's all sacred in a sense, you know. That's not to give it the kind of sort of cliched idea of what sacred spiritual people do or something like that. It's just an idea of reverence. There's an innate reverence for life, for all beings. And
for the system that produced it, sort of.
Well, you mean like for...
the entire system that produced this miracle of life and existence that we are sort of all sort of grasping to figure out what
like
was
earth and sky and the sun and nature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right, okay. We'll take a break here in just a minute, but let me ask one more related question to that. If there was a sacred dimension to time, you also mentioned that the 260-day calendar was equivalent to this 9-month gestation period.
Mm-hmm.
So birth is a part of this that's important to them.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. How so?
Well, this does relate to 2012. 260 is a key unit, and it was thought to be sort of a gestational process. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the 260-day period, birth happens. Now, in the long count calendar that gives us the 2012 end date, there are these catoon periods. Catoon.
How long is a catoon?
Just under 20 years. So they're sort of like generational periods, you might say. Mm-hmm. Like we have, you know, a generation.
Yeah, we call
20
it 20 years.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's 260 cartoons in one of these great cycles. And the current great cycle ends in 2012. So it's another sort of parallel usage of the 260 unit key number. And so this shows us how the Maya thought of the great cycle and the 2012 end date as a kind of a birth.
Mm.
You know, it's that paradigm that birth happens at the end of the process.
Right, and again, these different calendars and different cycles are sort of like wheels within wheels or something, because you have the 260-day period, which is essentially a birthing period, but then you have a much larger 26,000-year period, which is
Procession,
but also similarly a birth metaphor.
That's right. The microcosm reflects the macrocosm, and the smaller reflects the larger. It's all a congruent system, and I believe that Maya perception is a true insight into the way that the world is structured, you know.
In a real sense.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
It's not just a belief or something. See, this gets into the whole discussion of how the Maya, what I sort of realized as I was peeling back the layers of an onion over many years of research and rephrasing my questions and figuring out how to ask the right questions to get the right answers. It was always on a trajectory of trying to get to the core, the dang on siege, the thing in itself, you know, try to get to the core of what it was. Not trying to sort of just invent some kind of new system, but actually trying to figure out what the core thing is that the Maya understood. And I think what I realized is that they had achieved a kind of perennial wisdom. Like these universal principles that we find at the core of all of the world's great religious traditions, you know, that's what the modern world is incredibly dislocated from. We inherit this paradigm that is divorced from feeling a connection with the whole. We sort of are the inheritors of this atomized, fragmented value system, you know, as if that is like the ultimate thing. So we're in a crisis, you know. The modern world is going through a crisis. You know, there's fundamental flaws that lie at the root of our civilization's assumptions about reality.
Right, right, which is becoming quite apparent now people who are paying attention.
Yeah, the consequences of having those flawed attitudes towards nature or, you know, towards life or whatever, are coming back to bite us on the butt.
Mm-hmm. In a big way, yeah. All right, I think that's a good place to take a little break, okay? We will do that, and we'll come back, and we'll talk a little bit more about this perennial philosophy, I think. And use the word core, and I'm going to use that again in a few minutes, I think, okay? All right, everybody, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And we've got John Major Jenkins in the radio studio here with me. Hey, John, I want to give out your website address.
Okay, it's alignment2012.com.
That's right, alignment2012.com. Lots of interesting information there at the website, and you can link over there from my site as well. And I might encourage you to take a peek in my archives, and of course not right now, but maybe after this program or sometime later in the week, if you like what you hear tonight, take a look back and see some of the earlier conversations that I had with John over the last couple of years. They're all very interesting and entertaining, I would add. And you might learn a little bit more if you're interested in this stuff. So we will be back with John Major Jenkins in just a few minutes. And we will hear another song in the meantime from my friend Bartholomew Bean. Hey, Bart, I'm going to ask you to come close to me by the mic so you can tell me what this song is.
It's a song entitled Night of Nights.
Night of Nights, okay. And my friend Bartholomew Bean is also here in the studio with us, and he is a local regional singer, songwriter, artist, writing interesting, catchy tunes about lots of different things. And tonight we're sort of getting a peek at his esoteric side. And anyway, Bart's great, and if you ever get a chance to see him out and about this area, do so, okay? Here's a little sample of what you'll hear if you do that. Track number 5, yep, got it. And back with you and all in just a minute, okay? It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia.
Stand upon the hill. The moonlight is blowing slowly across fog that dwells the bottomlands below me. As I listen, come the calls, the lonesome whippoorwills, as they call out to another. On this night of nights, will I choose to look above me, to cast my glance to the universe, the place once forth is calm, this planet whereupon I stand, and all that lives about me sings a song of glorious reverence to that which has brought them forth to live upon this land. Cast out all my thoughts to try and know this moment well, to allow it to fill my heart with the full intent of its purest notion. My mind, it overflows. I must make room to hold its glory, but I find a selfish tenant who thinks that this is his own story.
Welcome back, everybody. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. Bartholomew Bean, that was called Night of Nights. And I think that's on a CD called Sedona Flyaway, if I remember correctly. And you can check out Bart on the web. Just do a little search for Bartholomew Bean. I know he has some interesting stuff on YouTube and maybe a MySpace. I'm not sure. But, well, whatever. Go out there and take a look, okay? It is about now 4 minutes after the midnight hour. Now the 19th of February, 2008. Happy birthday to my mama. She turned 78 years old today, as a matter of fact. And I just spoke with her. Yeah, so anyway, for my mom, hello. And thanks, Mom, for taking care of me when I was a little guy and when I couldn't take care of myself. Maybe I still can't for the most part. Anyhow. It's a pleasure to be with all of you, and it is an absolute thrill for me tonight because I have my friend John Major Jenkins in the studio with me, but I also have two other friends. My friend Ian from the West Coast is here with me, and Bart, of course, is in the studio, and got all you listening to us from wherever you are, and we got the chat room sort of hopping and gurgling along in there too. So between all of this stuff, we will come up with a radio show and continue along right now. Hey, John, let me ask you a question with regard to the perennial philosophy, the idea of the turning of age, of ages, and this sort of thing. You and I were speaking earlier today about the Indian system,
mm-hmm.
Kali Yuga and all this sort of thing. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the perennial philosophy, what it is, and the fact that there seem to be, at least in my estimation, a lot of different ancient cultures that had at least a piece of this.
Yeah. The perennial philosophy is something that can be seen operating below the surface of what appears to be many different religions and beliefs. You know, it sort of requires that one, pull aside the veil of appearances to see the core ideas, the core teachings, and what they represent. You know, the great mythologist Joseph Campbell was really great at identifying the shared archetypes, you know, that you see in many different traditions, from Christianity to Hinduism to Buddhism.
He was amazing, and the connections he was able to make between all of them were just stunning, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, he would tell stories that seemed to be different, but then he'd point out how archetypally, like symbolically, they were the same message.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how the perennial philosophy works, you know, and it sort of requires that we have an eye for the inner pattern. And, yeah.
Did the Indian culture, for example, and I don't mean Native American Indians, I mean people, you know, in the Hindu culture and the Indian I don't know what that is. Don't worry. It's KOPN. It just comes and goes, that sort of stuff. So,
yeah.
But they believed that there were these sort of world ages, right? Where you
right.
had a golden age and a silver age, or a bronze age and an iron age, and they were correspondingly nasty or wonderful for those people that lived during those ages. Did the Maya see sort of a similar setup?
Yeah, well, generally speaking, apart from, you know, the specifics, this idea of world ages that you see in the Hindu Yuga doctrine, the doctrine of the Yugas, which basically says that humanity passes through a sequence of world ages, beginning with the golden age of pure light,
mm-hmm.
of pure spiritual consciousness, when humanity is in direct connection with the source,
the divine, mm-hmm.
the higher wisdom,
God, whatever,
you know,
that is.
Yeah, whatever
right.
it is, you know, with the true nature, and then in the process of time, humanity starts to forget that connection, and we pass from a golden age to a silver age, and then from there we go from silver to bronze.
Hmm.
We forget more of our
each
true
time
nature,
more of the teachings that were known in the past.
Forget. It's a process of forgetting.
Huh.
It's basically the ancient cosmogonic fall that we see in the biblical tradition. The fall of man.
Yeah.
And this is just an insight into the cycles of time. All cycles in nature, and you know, this could be observed in the agricultural world and the life cycle of a human being, the life cycle of anything that comes into manifestation. All cycles in nature go through, there's two halves. There's a descending half and an ascending half.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from the day cycle to the moon cycle to the year cycle,
we see this.
There's a waning and a waxing. There's a period of increase and a period of decrease. Mm-hmm. So this Yuga model of the world ages, where humanity forgets, has an ultimate sort of turning point that has to be reached. It's the point of complete dislocation and disconnect from being aware that we are divine eternal beings.
Hmm.
It's basically the era in which ego, which is, you know, the ego is just our identities, our local identities, you might say.
That's a nice way to put it, yeah.
And, you know, it's the era in which the ego is seen to be the only true identity.
Right, certainly the primary method that we experience life through. Right,
right. But the point is that there's the other half of the process is when we are remembering. We're going through a process of moving from the densest age of Kali Yuga, of the Iron Age, and then the next age is the Bronze Age, and we're starting to remember more.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Silver Age. We're basically returning back into having a right relationship with our true self,
right. Well,
a direct connection with the divine.
Right. Well, now we're getting to sort of the heart of the matter, no pun intended, because I think that in my own experience and many, many people that I deal with and talk to and hang out with or whatever, or talk to on the radio, you know, whatever, many people feel that we are in that type of a time frame now where ancient mysteries, old secrets, you know, things that have not been revealed for a long, long time are now starting to come back out and make themselves more visible and apparent, that we are sort of remember. I mean, this whole business that you're involved in, I mean, this is nothing more than us learning about our past.
That's right. And, you know, I'm glad you brought it up in that kind of a framework, Mike, because, you know, we can talk about what's going on as a remembering or an awakening.
Mm-hmm.
Awakening. Let's think about that term, that word, awakening.
Mm-hmm.
When you wake up, you're returning to a state that you were in before you fell asleep.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that's already there. Awakening is a remembering. This isn't about the evolution of consciousness, as if we're going to achieve states that we never had achieved before. This is stripping away the illusions that keep us from seeing the ultimate state of consciousness that is possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that state in which we're in a direct communion with our true eternal selves.
And which possibly or probably has existed at some time in the deep past.
Yeah, or it's at least latently there.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically the state that we were in before we were born.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's this... There's a gentleman that put a question up on the forum, and I think it's worthy to ask now. He says that history is full of revolutionary millenarian movements that have expired, and their deadlines for apocalypse have come and gone, and the only thing that's really constant is change and crisis. But that those things have yet to culminate. He asked, what makes the alignment that we're talking about and the Mayan cosmology any different from other, you know, well-thought-out eschatological ideas?
Well, I think it's a very compelling empirical fact. I suppose that, you know, I should probably... you know, clarify that I'm not really making a case for this being like, how do I really phrase this? I suppose I'd like us to just dwell upon the likelihood that the ancient Maya did indeed create this paradigm that utilizes the galactic center as a focal point,
mm-hmm.
and that they were aware of the precession of the equinoxes, and they were aware of the galactic alignment, a concept, actually an empirical fact, that only has come into modern consciousness in the last 10, 15, 20 years.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, the fact that it is an actual astronomical event that we're talking about, a fact,
right.
About things that are going to happen in the heavens.
So we don't even know if this galactic alignment could actually have demonstrable empirical effects in terms of energetic changes and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we do know that the precession of the equinoxes, there was a theory that was proposed by James Croll, a Scottish independent maverick thinker in the 1870s and 80s. His idea was basically that this precession of the equinoxes that was known at that time is the reason why we have ice ages.
Huh.
And his theory was ridiculed, mainly because he was an outsider. And then...
Of course.
Yeah, and he died, and, was forgotten. And then in the 1920s, another researcher named Milankovic reawakened Kroll's theory.
Mm-hmm.
And now we know through... The model is much more complex. It's not just every 26,000 years we get an ice age or something. But it is now believed that precession is related to these ice age cycles, climate warming, and so on.
Interesting.
So we can definitely say that precession has something to do with the kinds of change that the Earth undergoes. Now, that's a little bit of a digression. I think that the question is really an interesting one. Millenarian movements definitely hinge around, certain things. And I'm not really making a case that... we should start a millenarian movement and start wearing placards and standing on street corners, the end is near, and all this kind of stuff. I'm interested in, first of all, reconstructing this lost galactic cosmology, and then asking the question, could they have been onto something?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Could galactic alignments sort of be an unrecognized armature of cyclic change on the planet over large periods of time?
Right. Okay, well, let's talk about the alignment then. For people, again, who are new to this material, if you can describe what's actually going to happen, that would probably be helpful. I know it's a little bit difficult over the radio without imagery, but you've done it plenty before, I'm sure.
So. Well, sure, and people can go to my website, actually, that homepage, alignment2012.com, and I bet it's about 3/4 of the way down the front page now. It used to be right up at the top, but I've added so many events and comments to the front page there. It's basically the link towards the bottom that says, what is the galactic alignment?
There it is, right there. Yeah,
so
yeah.
One can click on that and actually look at an illustration of what it is. So I'd like to sort of explain what it is, and then I'll explain what it isn't. Because there's a very common misconception that is often labeled the galactic alignment.
Okay.
Well, basically, the galactic alignment is the apparent alignment of the December solstice sun, the position of the December solstice sun in the sky from the vantage point of Earth, of course.
Uh-huh.
We're here on Earth, lining up with the center of the Milky Way galaxy. Now, the center of the Milky Way galaxy is the nuclear bulge of the Milky Way.
Mm-hmm.
We can see the Milky Way galaxy if we're out camping or in August, especially if you look towards the south, you can see the arching white road of the Milky Way.
Mm-hmm.
And naked eye sky watchers like the Maya could notice that there's an area of the Milky Way that's wider and there's more bright stars in there. That's the nuclear bulge of the galactic center. It's a complete misnomer, and it's often stated as a criticism of my theory by scholars or astronomers that the Maya could not have known where the galactic center is located. That is a misapplication of a very precise scientific definition of what the galactic center is, which is some kind of abstract scientific point in the sky. And how could the Maya have known where that point was? Well, see, that's what scientists do, by way of trying to critique something. They misapply modern, precise scientific notions and assume that ancient naked-eye sky watchers must also have been ascribing to the same concepts.
Mm-hmm. So they may not have been interested in the little point that you're talking about.
No, it's a complete abstract idea.
Mm-hmm.
But they did notice that there was this bulging area, and in their mythology, they thought of it as the womb of the Great Mother. So
uh-huh.
they did think of it as a creation place,
mm-hmm.
And a center.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so basically the alignment in 2012, and it doesn't happen just in 2012. That needs to be emphasized, too. I like to think of an alignment zone that runs from 1980 to 2016.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the work that I've been engaged in is to lend clarity and discernment to languaging what these things are. You know, back in the early 90s when I started getting into this, there were no clear definitions of what the galactic alignment was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so and but it is something that can be defined in a very you know, clear way.
In a specific way, yeah.
Yeah.
I know that the Naval Observatory, for example, is at least mm-hmm. marks it on their own calendar, right?
Well, their data allows one to calculate it. The European astronomer Jean Mius, in his book Mathematical Astronomy Morsels, made the calculation of it.
Mm.
The important thing to try to understand how the ancient Maya were figuring this out is that all of it's possible with naked eye sky watching. It doesn't involve some kind
radio
of advanced telemetry
and,
that was, you know, airlifted in by space aliens or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
It is a true achievement of a brilliant people that were working about 2,100 years ago in southern Mexico. In fact, one of the questions I asked, well, this long count calendar that gives us the 2012 end date, where was it invented?
Right. This is one of the central points of your work.
The key site is this place called Izapa.
Izapa.
It's this amazing site with alignments, with carved monuments, with the creation mythology imagery, and so it's all right there. That's the galactic alignment is basically the alignment of the December solstice sun with the galactic equator in the spot where the nuclear bulge of the galactic center is located.
Okay.
Now, what the galactic alignment is not, you see this in the literature, and it's really quite frustrating. There's another notion. It's based upon the fact that our solar system orbits the center of the Milky Way galaxy. Our galaxy is spiral-shaped, and we're out here on one of the arms. Everything is spiraling around and orbiting the center of the Milky Way galaxy. It takes something like 280 million years for our sun to orbit the galactic center. There's a theory that our solar system doesn't orbit the galactic center in just a disk. There's actually like a standing wave pattern in which our solar system moves above and below the midplane
mm-hmm.
of the...
Yeah.
And so the idea is that when we're passing through the midplane, we somehow encounter more debris that lies along the midplane, and so there's more asteroids and stuff like this.
Yeah.
There's a couple of problems with this theory. One is that this theory has nothing to do with 2012. It's said that our sun will be passing through the midplane in 2012, but this seems to be some kind of weird, distorted conflation with the galactic alignment idea, because it would take... If it's thought to be the orbital motion, it's going to take something like a 500,000 years
for
us to pass through this midplane. Another problem with this theory is that if our solar system, if our sun is obeying the gravitational dictates of this standing waves sinusoidal pattern, everything else is too.
Mm.
So we're not going to encounter some other stray asteroids. You know, everything's following this.
Yeah,
whatever force it is that causes the orbital pattern to be warped in this standing wave pattern, everything's going to obey those laws
too. Same laws, yeah.
So it's a weird sort of idea that's been picked up. But it's definitely not what the galactic alignment is.
Okay. But the galactic alignment does have to do with this core, the center, or that particular area of the galaxy. And I think it's important that you did make the distinction that this does not require sophisticated equipment or whatever. This is something that these people and, frankly, you, me, or whoever, if we had the notion, could do with the naked eye if you knew what you were looking for and what you were looking at.
Right.
Okay, so... Obviously, they were very interested in the center of the galaxy, the so-called galactic core. I think it's interesting that this is where birth, again, sort of takes place when you talk about stellar births, you know, the beginnings of stars and formations of different stellar bodies. We find that as we move closer to the center of our galaxy, or any galaxy for that matter, you get, man, it becomes a boiling furnace of who knows what. But why do you think that was significant to them?
Well, I think that whole image of the fires of creation was very central to their religion, because their idea around time cycles is that at the end of a cycle, it's not a final end.
Mm-hmm.
All these ideas that get glommed on to the 2012 date, you know, that it's
end of
Armageddon,
world.
End of
right.
the world, is really, to me, is in my opinion, it's a projection of the fear mm-hmm. and one-dimensional linear time concept of our own Judeo-Christian tradition being projected onto what is essentially a cyclic time philosophy mm-hmm. that doesn't believe in final ends, but believes in transformation and renewal.
Right, right.
And that's why the image of the fire, the central fires of creation, is significant.
Hmm. And the language, again, is important. In other words, it's not the end of the Mayan calendar that we're talking about. It is the end of a particular cycle in an ongoing calendar that can be sort of pursued forward into history ad infinitum.
Yeah, it's kind of a bit of a problem with our language, too, because it's just conventional to say end date of the calendar mm-hmm. or cycle ending or the end. It's not the end of the Maya calendar. The Maya calendar does not end. We use similar terms in like, oh, at the end of the day, you know, it's just, you know, we don't have to, you know, try real hard to misunderstand that,
right,
you know.
Right.
It's sort of a willful misunderstanding of what it isn't.
Okay.
But don't the Maya speak of...
Hold on. Let's see here. We have a friend of ours here in the studio who wants to chime in. What microphone are you on? Mic 2. What's your name, sir, and what's your question?
This is Bartholomew here.
All right. You got a question for John?
I was wondering, the Hopi and the Maya, don't they have their traditional... oral traditions that speak of worlds?
Right.
Yeah, the fourth world, the fifth world, the fifth sun, the fourth sun, yeah.
The end of a world age, yeah. But that's really just the end of a cycle of time, not the end of a whole universe or the end of the earth or anything
right.
like that.
Right. Well, I was wondering if say, the conjunction where our solar system travels across or into the center line of forces that are forming the galaxy itself.
Mm-hmm.
If that were to kind of, if that were to pull our planets and do change our dance so that we dance differently after we passed by it, would that constitute a new world?
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. I think that in some way things are going to be shaken up, you know. But I guess it might be more in our value system, perhaps. Like things are going to be flipped back to, at least the way that I think about it is that things will be flipped back into having a right relationship. At least that's the possibility. These are all things that I think, like, astrophysicists should be looking at. There's a couple of interesting things around this alignment and precession that I've been trying to put on the table, you know, to talk to physicists about. And It could very well be that these types of alignments do cause reconfigurations.
Hmm. I had a guy send me an email about 3 or 4 days ago and said, ask John if he believes or if he thinks it's possible that there may be an energetic force involved, that when this alignment occurs or when we get close enough to it. I really like the fact that you sort of describe it more as a window of opportunity, sort of in between this 36 year period, I think, that you choose, 1980
yeah.
plus or minus to 2016. But at a particular time during this phase, that there might actually be an energy exchange between the galactic core, for example, I don't know, maybe not, but and our planet, or our sun, perhaps, that might instigate change, including maybe a change like Bart's talking about, you know, change
yeah.
the actual way the planets move, or maybe an energetic change climatically or all kinds of things, maybe.
I guess the reason why I try to steer clear of that type of languaging of it is that it implies that there are forces that impinge upon us and cause some kind of predetermined effect.
Mm.
And I sort of resist that sort of on principle. I mean, I suppose it's a little of both in the sense that, like, you can say that the sun's going to rise tomorrow at such and such a time. That's a definite thing. You know, it's not really a prediction like Nostradamus would make or something.
Right.
And so it does imply that there's a certain framework of predetermined events that are going to happen. The sun's going to rise tomorrow. But it doesn't mean that everybody's going to wake up precisely at that moment. Mm. See, there's still an element of free will. So when we language things in the language of, you know, forces and effects and things like this, that's interesting and it's valid in its own realm, but I think that I'm more interested in how change actually happens. And I think that change happens to the degree that we can open up to new possibilities and unknowns. We, you know, the sun can come up tomorrow, but we can sleep through the day if we choose.
Right. So it's individual and personal in a way too.
Yeah, it's a bit of both. You know, I sort of go back and forth between the two. The reason why I sort of resist the dwelling upon the literal sort of, I think that's all really interesting though. I guess I should just hang on this for a minute because. In my book, Galactic Alignment, I address this, and I look at the work of Oliver Reiser, who was an amazing thinker.
Who was he?
He was a philosophy professor at the University of Pittsburgh for 50 years. He actually worked with Einstein to help Einstein language his theories in a sort of a more accessible way for readers.
Uh-huh.
He was brilliant, and he proposed this theory called cosm ecology, this idea of how energy in the universe coming into the Earth affects the evolution of consciousness. It's this really interesting model. He was not aware of the galactic alignment, but what I proposed is that if we insert the galactic alignment into his work, you could see how there could be a model made that uses the galactic alignment as sort of a trigger for consciousness. This is all coming at it from the vantage point of sort of mechanistic science, and again, I sort of resist that. I guess I like to think of these things more from the vantage point of a kind of perennial philosophy. It's not just poetic metaphor, but I like to think of the galactic alignment as us coming back into union with the cosmic heart and source. That seems to be a nice poetic reading of what the galactic alignment is. Mm-hmm. Now, if that is the case, how do we respond to that? Do we open up to that as some kind of blessing of reconnection with the cosmic heart and source, our true selves, or do we resist it? Well, in fact, I think that's what we have going on in the world today, playing itself out. There's great resistance to what's, you know, could actually be an incredible thing of us coming back into right relationship with our true selves. I mean, because of the crisis that's going on in the world, that does seem to be the thing that needs to happen so that we can actually facilitate a successful transformation and renewal. It's not guaranteed. It's not predetermined. There's something we need to do.
Mm-hmm. It's participatory, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that something is basically to toss our illusions into the fire of transformation, the illusions that keep us fixated to these realms of limitation.
You have to admit that a major...
Well, hold on. Now, Bart Bean, you have to let me know when you're going to say something. I don't just have all the mics on all the time. There's, you know, not a second there. I know it's exciting. But all right, right back to you. Go ahead.
I was just saying you have to admit that a major change... A wave of change, like say that tsunami that took care of that, just wiped out all those different coastal cultures
in India.
That definitely, I mean, I guess you could say that definitely put everyone's perspective back toward themselves at that point in time.
Well, that's true. You know, things do happen, and you know, trauma can catalyze people to come together. We see this a lot. It's kind of human nature. Like if there's a tragedy, you know, people can gather around that and experience more of their humanity. You know, but then again, that's the good side of the picture that we see, and that often does happen. But there's also people that are maybe, you know, curling up into fear even more. Mm-hmm. So it's always a little bit of both. You know, that's the thing about free will.
You know, a person in the chat room mentioned that 2001 that he felt or she felt was one of these significant shift type periods, and I imagine they referenced the 9/11 issue because the world did, I guess, change quite a bit after that. But I think also about ancient history and ancient changes. I read an article that I have, I actually just pulled up on the site here, about a 9,500 year old city that has recently been found off the coast of India, this place called the Gulf of Cambay. Listen to this. Maybe you heard this or not, John. It's from the BBC News from about a month ago. The remains of what has been described as a huge lost city may force historians and archaeologists to radically reconsider their view of ancient history. Marine scientists say archaeological remains discovered 120 feet underwater in the Gulf of Cambay off the western coast of India could be over 9,000 years old. The vast city stretches over 5 miles long and 2 miles wide and is believed to predate the oldest known remains in the subcontinent by more than 5,000 years. So, again, I think this is a perfect example of how little we know about the past and how we are essentially trying to remember. And we're getting tips here and there, apparently, to help us remember.
Yeah, and that's really fascinating stuff. Because, you know, David Frawley, a Vedic astrologer, has been writing for years about how old the wisdom in the Vedas really is.
Yeah.
And he can date it. He's actually has this method for dating some of the references in the Vedic scriptures by moon positions and eclipses and certain constellations. There's indications that some of this information must be datable to about 9,000 BC. And then on top of that, you have the work of Graham Hancock, for example, who he's been doing dives off of coastal regions for years in his book Underworld.
Yeah, that place in Japan.
Japan. I wouldn't be surprised if he's already dived on this place off of India.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is that location considered to be part of Pan or Pangaea?
I don't know.
Pangaea would have been that sort of unified continent idea, I think. That would go back to, you know, 65 million years ago.
Right, assuming plate tectonics and all that stuff is what we think it is and all that. That's a good question, but I'm not sure that we can answer that, really. I think that if you read further in the story, you'll find out that there were certainly structures that, I mean, this was a pretty sophisticated thing, whatever it was that was going on 9,000 years ago, because it's very obvious that there's huge stonework. This is one of the most remarkable things, and I think it's a good chance to sort of transition a little bit into monuments and such, because if you go to ancient sites around the planet, if you go in Central and South America, if you go into Mexico, if you go to Vietnam, if you go to China, if you go certainly to Giza in Egypt, we find Baalbek, Lebanon, right? We find these stonework that is just over the top. I mean, any engineer worth his salt will look you straight in the eye and say, I got no idea how the hell they did this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This place that we're talking about off the coast of India is similar. One of the things that's obvious in their original discovery was that huge, huge stones, right? The Maya were doing amazing things with stone. Could you talk a little bit about the monuments and why they're important? And talk about some of the monuments, maybe, you know, just in general.
Well, it's amazing how just on the level of like an architectural achievement, engineering achievements in South America, and these stones are sort of like silent sentinels to something amazing that they had achieved. And we can appreciate that from our own value system of engineering achievement And that's great, you know, and you're right. You know, engineers will look at this and say, this is absolutely amazing. But I still think that, and I just want to sort of propose this idea that we are sort of like cognitively and mentally unprepared to really fully understand and appreciate what these ancient people were about. and my sense is that they were, this is going to sound radical, but in some ways they were more sophisticated than we are today.
That's, I think that's not so, I mean, the more you study them, you'll find that's not such an unreasonable statement.
In the sense that they, okay, yes, they did not have the technologies that we have. I mean, we assume that technology is the indicator of sophistication.
Mm-hmm.
Did they have 24...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Did they have 24 packs of beer?
No, and they did not have 79 flavors of potato chips or resealable plastic bags. So clearly they had some evolution to achieve. Yeah, that's the funny thing. So we have all these technological marvels, and it is amazing what our culture has been able to achieve. But at the same time, that seems to have come at a price.
A huge price.
You know, and it's not to romanticize the ancients. That's not what I'm trying to do. But I do believe that there's perceptual and cognitive differences that make it very, very hard for us to really appreciate and understand what they were about.
Yeah, I think that's a huge point to make, that we are, we're sort of imprisoned by our own belief systems, cultures that we grow up in or whatever, scientific philosophies, all of the ideologies that we are surrounded by. I mean, we're fish in water, and the water that we swim in is a lot different than the water that the Maya were swimming in, apparently.
Yeah. And so when a breakthrough happens in understanding the Maya worldview or paradigm, I believe that my work in the mid-90s was a breakthrough because I put everything on the table and showed how everything's interconnected. Mm-hmm. There's the galactic alignment. There's the creation mythology with the hero twins. That encodes the galactic alignment. There's the ball game, and its symbolism encodes the galactic alignment. Mm-hmm. And so on and so on. It's not so much a matter of finding more evidence and data. It's all there, staring us right in the face.
Right.
What is required is a perceptual shift in how we are processing the information that's right before our eyes. And that's where the breakthroughs happen.
Right, and to be able to put it together and make sense of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right. The monuments at Izapa. Why are they more significant than other monuments?
Okay, yeah, the monuments and the different sites and so on.
And Izapa again is the place that you believe is
right.
Sort of the foundation of the Long Count.
Right. There's over 60 carved monuments preserved at Izapa. They're pictographic. They're not hieroglyphic, so they're easy to look at and see the hero twins, or there's the bird deity, or there's the father of the hero twins. You know, it's basically. The carved monument program at Izapa is all about the Maya creation mythology. Now, these monuments are lined up in certain ways with the horizons. Mm-hmm. And, say, one of the main orientation points for Izapa is the December solstice horizon.
Mm-hmm.
So you might have a solar deity portrayed on one of the carved monuments. And then you notice that carved monument faces the horizon where the December solstice sun rises. So there's this sort of integrated picture where you can start to interpret and read not only the creation mythology on the monuments, but the astronomical references that are also portrayed. So the whole package is there at Izapa. You not only have an encryption of the galactic alignment that maximizes in the years around 2012, you have the Maya creation mythology that sort of tells the story of that.
Mm-hmm.
And you also have integrated into that whole picture the what you might call a prophecy for 2012, as well as spiritual teachings. Spiritual teachings that are appropriate for citizens of cycle endings.
Man. Okay, I think that's a place for us to take a little bit of a break, okay?
Okay.
I can collect some questions here from the chat room as well. A lot of good stuff coming up in there. Okay, everybody, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My guest is John Major Jenkins on the web at alignment2012.com. You can link over there from my site. And we have a number of programs in the archives between myself and John. This one will be available in the next couple days for sure, and you can download it and share it with your friends if you like, okay? In the meanwhile, we will play another piece of music here from my friend Bart Bean, and come back and talk with John in just a few minutes, okay? It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, on the web at KOPN.org, and my website, of course, MikeHagan.com. KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Mike Hagan here, glad to be with y'all. About 10 minutes now before the hour of 1 a.m. on the 19th of February. In the studio with me, John Major Jenkins, Bartholomew Bean, and my friend Ian. I won't say his last name because he's wanted by many people. I don't mean that in a bad way. Sort of a nice way, actually. John, before we get back to our conversation, I want to let people know what's happening tomorrow night. We have a couple hours here in Columbia at the Blue Fugue tomorrow night down on 9th Street between 7 o'clock and 9 o'clock at night, where John will be... I'm sorry, doing your tap dance routine?
Yes.
It's actually quite impressive, too. He does a soft shoe that's really nice, too. But at any rate, once the dancing is over, John will be talking about...
It's just very informal, lot of, you know, interaction questions. I just want to lay out some ideas for conversation, really.
Okay, well, that's what we'll do, and you all are welcome. We've got plenty of room over there for 20, 30, 40 people, 50 if we can. I mean, we can pack the place if we can, but I'd certainly like to see any and all of you out there, and it'd be a great chance for me to get to meet some more of my listeners as well, and I always love to do that. So, your opportunity, a great one, to meet in person this amazing guy who's been doing incredible work for many, many years, someone who I have a tremendous amount of respect for and who I've just been fascinated with for years. I mean, when I was first introduced to this Maya material, it was in relation to my friend Terrence McKenna, of course, who we talk about a lot on this program, and John knew Terrence, and their work certainly parallels in many ways. And tomorrow night, John Major Jenkins will be at the Blue Fugue right here in Columbia from 7 until 9, and then we'll be hanging out afterwards, I'm sure. But if you're interested in coming down and getting a chance to pick his brain a little bit or just to sit back and hear what he has to say, tomorrow's the night, okay? 7 o'clock at the Blue Fugue on 9th Street, John Major Jenkins, tomorrow night, Tuesday, the night, actually it's tonight now, the 19th of February, okay? All right. John, the creation mythology is super important. Obviously, it's encoded all over the place. My question is it possible that the creation mythology is a clue pointing to the end date? In other words, does it let us expect anything, or have you ever made a connection between the end of the cycle and the beginning?
Yeah, that's the most amazing thing about the... you know, the teachings that can be recovered at the site of Azapa, and provides a window into sort of the esoteric inner teachings of the creation myth, really. And it works on several different levels. There's this principle that Maya mythology is related to astronomy. Linda Sheely, the great Maya scholar, brought this out, and it seems to be the case for the Maya and many other ancient cultures. So the creation mythology is actually encoding astronomical processes. And the entire creation myth is about the resurrection or rebirth of the father of the hero twins. And that signals the end of the myth, the end of the age. It's the thing that happens at the end of the world age. So one way that this works is that the father of the hero twins, One Hunapu, symbolizes the December solstice sun. So the whole myth is a metaphor for the rebirth of the December solstice sun at the end of the age. Mm-hmm. And when you understand the other astronomical references, you see that the whole thing is an encryption of the galactic alignment process.
Hmm.
So that's how it works on just the tangible level of astronomy. But there's also like a prophecy, you might say, and there's also spiritual teachings part of that package.
Okay. All right. From the chat room, Mike, let's pick John's personal side a bit and ask him why he chose Kahib as his email address.
Oh, I just typed in my response to that. Kahib is the number 4 in the K'iche' Maya language, and N-O-J, is my day sign of birth.
Oh,
so right. it's my birthday in the Tolkien calendar.
All right, fair enough.
We have another question here.
Oh, let me see. Ian's coming into the mix here. Go ahead, my friend.
All right. Hello, everybody.
Hi, Ian.
So just kind of running with the idea that you said not only is there this astronomical aspect to the galactic alignment.
Yeah.
I wanted to quote a little passage here and just get your sort of riff on this. Of course, it's from your seminal work, or in my opinion, the seminal work on everything Maya in 2012 called Maya Cosmogenesis 2012 under the section called Neo-Shamans Unite. So, the question remains, did the ancient Mayan visionaries actually travel into the galactic center in heightened states of consciousness? How can we know for sure? The only way to test this theory, of course, would be to repeat the experiment. Well, what would be possible if a team of neo-shamans opened their minds to the galactic center? Their shamanistic goal would be not only to find the cosmic center, but to go into it.
I like it.
Yeah, there's a lot of little gems in that book. What's the question? I guess when I wrote that, I was sort of a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but sort of suggesting that if we want to really understand the wisdom of the Maya, that maybe we should avail ourselves of the same tools of vision that they themselves were using.
All right. Well, that leads us to another question that actually is related to monuments, because they also made these stone mushrooms that we find littered about in many different places in South and Central Mexico. We know now pretty certainly that the Maya were using in a ceremonial sense, in a ritual sense, in a sacred sense, these plants, these mushrooms, psilocybin-containing mushrooms, frankly. Is that what you were referencing to there in the book?
Yeah, that's where that passage leads into the section on shamanic tools of vision. And it's quite clear that at the site of Azapa, especially, there was this sacred mushroom called Going On. So there's this profound galactic cosmovision that got pioneered at Azapa.
Mm-hmm.
And they formulated the Long Count calendar to encode this understanding of our changing relationship to the galaxy and this future galactic alignment. And they created a mystery play to go with it, the Maya creation myth, that told the story of the rebirth of the father of the hero twins and the dynamics that occur. And so it seems to me that the shamans and day keepers and calendar priests, whatever you want to call them, cosmonauts, I don't know, were availing themselves of these tools of vision in the environment. And the sacred mushroom cult, I don't know if you'd call it a religion or how they were using it, I'm not really sure, but I guess we have a good indication of how they were probably utilizing these things from the surviving mushroom cult in Mazatec country that Gordon Wasson
discovered. Maria Sabina.
Yeah, in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was used as an oracle. It was used as a vehicle for seeing the unseen dimension and expanding the perception into the invisible realms. You know, sort of accessing the full multidimensional capacity of the human mind.
Of the human mind, right.
And when this is the trajectory and this is the sort of motivation behind using these substances, it gives access to this larger field of connections, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that could very well have triggered the great integrative vision that the Long Count 2012 date, creation mythology complex of ideas really encodes.
Well, it does seem to me, at least to a certain extent, that the ideas that come out of it were very strange and unique and seemed not particularly human. In other words, it does seem to me to make sense that they were accessing information somehow that wasn't readily available to maybe you and me and or anybody else, unless they were in some sort of a mystical state or something.
Well, yeah, that's probably true. But also it could be seen as just a standard sort of advance of cosmological understanding, in the same way that as human beings understand their relationship to the cosmos in ever-enlarging ways, mm-hmm. we can track sort of the evolution of cosmological thinking. You know, in the West, it was the heliocentric, the geocentric model surpassed by the heliocentric model. So notice how it's going from ever larger sort of vantage points.
Right,
well, the Maya had this galacto-centered model that they pioneered. It's like they skipped the heliocentric phase.
Uh-huh.
And in terms of the sociological implications of this, I think, need to be pointed out, because it's not just about scientific physical objects that they're looking at. They're actually seeing these astronomical objects in the full symbolic import that they have. Like, for example, the galactic center just isn't that spot in the sky. The galactic center is the womb of the mother.
Mm.
And the sun is the seed of the father.
Uh-huh.
And so when the seed of the father goes into the womb of the mother at the end of the cycle, that engenders a new world age. That's how they would have thought about it and mm-hmm. talked about it.
Right.
That's what I mean when I say we need to shift our perceptual cognitive understanding of these things. I try to translate these things into sort of scientific terms that we can, because it seems like our own cognitive processing needs these tangible, literal things in order to bite into.
And it's required, the culture seems to require it, whether we like it or not, just to get legitimacy, basically.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you got to have the math and science behind your idea, or otherwise they tell you to go away.
But a lot gets lost in the process. It's like translating ancient Greek poetry into pidgin English or something like that.
Yeah. All right. One more question the mushroom stones and the fact that they were using visionary plants to do something. We had this strange connection then between this guy Terence McKenna and the fact that in his own work, and you and I have talked about this at length before, but people are asking about it again, so we just address it really quickly. Terence, who approached the world essentially from a rationalist scientific standpoint, but was willing to hang out on the fringe and take the data wherever it led him, came across the 2012 time frame, at least, from a completely different angle that he approached it from. You know, the Chinese oracle, the I Ching, and his own psilocybin experiments. But do you find it unique, or do you find it interesting that he and perhaps others did or are doing exactly what you mentioned in your book that Ian just read? In other words, if a shaman with the right intention does something the same way that the Maya were doing it, could he essentially come up with the same information?
I think so, yeah, in a nutshell.
Yeah.
I think, if anything, 2012 represents the transcendent dimension encountered by human beings.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like that rupture of plane. But it's also our encounter with the timeless, in a sense. And it gets into sort of those paradoxical union of opposite images that are sort of difficult to process, in a sense, you know, because, I don't know, it's like, how do you locate the timeless on a calendar?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I think that there's something intrinsic to the psychedelic experience, especially with mushrooms, that has to do with opening up the consciousness into the immediate felt experience of the now.
Mm-hmm.
So eternity is not a long period of time. Eternity is the timeless. So when an initiate or when a a sincere seeker who is availing themselves of these tools in a sacred manner, because it does require a certain sort of preparation and mindset. However it happens, if a person can glimpse the timeless, then you can say that you've already been to 2012. You know, to the extent that 2012 represents our encounter with the eternal, divine, timeless ground of all being. Now, that's a term that comes direct from the perennial philosophy. The ground of all being is this eternal, infinite, unmanifest source of all manifestation. Everything comes from that. All created beings come from that, and all created beings return into that. You know, and so when we can catch a glimpse of that through having an initiatory experience, you know, in the same way that the ancient mystery religions did.
Sure, at Eleusis or wherever else.
And should be said too that that is an institution that has been eliminated from modern society. It's been replaced by, you know, evil sort of handmaiden replacements. You know, our rituals of initiation are some kind of twisted perversions of
that. Yeah, the bar mitzvah, you know, or your confirmation or something like
those,
that.
Well, if the original sort of inflection of that is retained, then that could be a good sort of, if it's fully experienced as to what it is. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the tendency is in religions to formalize what were originally more like ecstatic openings into the transcendent. And I love to quote the words of the perennial philosopher Syed Hossein Nasser, amazing thinker. He says that all true knowledge comes from an ecstatic connection into the transcendent. So that's how the visionary experience really is the basis of all knowledge. You know, that opening to the transcendent.
Ian has a question, but let me add something really quickly. In the world today, again, this is something that we spoke about earlier, all three of us, we're in a situation where there is so much murkiness, so much information, so much misinformation, so much disinformation, so much stuff, right, that it becomes nearly impossible to be able to discern what's legitimate, what's valid, what's not, what you should be concerned with, what you shouldn't be concerned with. And again, in this conversation, we talked about how it is perhaps possible that through ecstatic means, you can get a better handle on what's shit and what's shinola.
Well, I think that that's very possible, not only because of the ecstatic nature of the experience, but because of the recentering trait that often comes with the experience, the sort of the reintegration back down into one's local identity, you might say, and that sort of what is sort of experienced in all of that is a recentering. So then, when you come at the world through that centered place, you can kind of just see through all the superficial BS and see. It's basically approaching life in a sacred way so you can see the essence behind the veil of appearances. That way you can see through all the noise and static.
Okay. Ian, what do you have?
Well, I was going to sort of continue that thread with these shamanic journeys that the Mayans were taking. But at the same time, sacred mushroom stones were also found to be of Olmec origin.
Mm-hmm. And Toltec. Mm-hmm.
And Toltec. And I know this is a sort of an area of speculation, but I run through my mind, you know, and like to hear your thoughts on where did the Mayan civilizations, where did they come from? Where did they originate?
Are they
a legacy civilization? I don't know. Your thoughts?
That's a good question. I don't have.
They're not that old. In other words, what we know about the Maya.
Yeah.
What's it go back? A couple thousand years? 3,000 years, maybe? Or
yeah.
But that's
the Olmec are older, of course.
We got a city here in Bombay off the coast that's 9,000 plus. So,
I guess I tend to think that I don't know the answers to a lot of these things. I'm perfectly willing to accept that the mysteries go way, way, way back. Mm. You know, I think that what we might be sort of getting at here in your question, Ian, is, you know, where do they come from? I guess there's several ways to answer that. Perhaps they came from Asia. Perhaps they came from Africa. Sometimes people believe that they came from some other planetary sphere, you might say. Sometimes it's called the Pleiades. These might be sort of like literal kind of languaging of what I think is really a more profound idea, in the sense that perhaps there are different dimensions in the universe, and perhaps that different groups from different dimensions colonize different areas in the same way that you know, we jump on boats and colonize another continent. Mm-hmm. You know, perhaps there's an incarnational process in which certain tribal groups, you know, come from different planetary spheres and incarnate into this sphere. Mm-hmm. You know, that's an interesting idea. I guess I tend to think that on one level we're all human beings here, and some human beings have learned how to have a connection with that that higher wisdom, and have learned how to integrate that higher wisdom into human affairs here on the planet. So it is kind of an area of speculation, but it's really interesting. Or I don't know if that answered your question.
You know, I don't know if there is an answer to that question.
That's true.
That's why I keep trying to figure it out.
Well, that's a good one. John, the Pleiades you mentioned, that's a unique aspect of some of your work, actually. You're recognize that the Maya had an interest in that particular set of stars. What's that about?
Well, the Pleiades are very important for their processional models. At the site of Chichen Itza in the Yucatan Peninsula, there's the Pyramid of Kukulcan, the Pyramid of the Plumed Serpent. And that is the site where many thousands of people go every equinox to look at the shadow serpent coming down the northern stairway.
It comes down the stairway, yeah.
It's a really an amazing thing. It required a certain degree of engineering ability to do that.
Yeah.
What I noticed in my work is that there seems to be an esoteric hidden thing going on in the symbolism of this, and it involves the Pleiades. The tail of the serpent, the shadow serpent.
Describe for people what's actually happening.
Okay, well, on the equinox at about 4:30 in the afternoon, when the sun's going down in the west,
mm-hmm.
there's a shadow that's cast by the sun. It's cast by the, you know, at the corner of the pyramid. The shadow is formed and is projected onto the northern stairway, and so it looks like an undulating serpent going down. Now, that's what people basically come to look at. But the tail of this shadow serpent would point up through the middle of the pyramid, and the rattle of the tail is called Zab, in Tzab, T-Z-A-B, mm-hmm. in the Yucatec Maya language.
Mm-hmm.
That's also the name for the Pleiades constellation.
Really?
It's the rattle constellation.
Oh, yeah.
So the snake is a solar deity. And so basically this is pointing to an alignment of the sun and the Pleiades in the zenith of the sky. In a nutshell, this is a processional alignment. It happens only in the 21st century, this century that we're in now. So this is why I identified the Pyramid of Kukulcan at Chichen Itza as a processional star clock in stone. This is really an incredible thing to be able to say. It puts this pyramid on the map as a processional star clock.
As a marker.
In a similar way that the pyramids in Egypt are supposedly lined up with, they have air shafts or, you know, sighting shafts that line up with certain stars in certain eras of precession. So that was heralded as a breakthrough, you know, among Egyptian researchers. Similarly, we can now think of the Pyramid of Kukulcan as basically an alarm clock set for the 21st century, at least for the latitude of Chichen Itza.
Mm-hmm. You make me think, you know, you've been talking about the Hero twins, and you just mentioned Egypt again, and I think about the story of Osiris and Horus and Set, the twin sons and the father again. Is this another story that's...
It's archetypally very similar to the hero twin creation myth among the Maya.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I bet that's not the only one. I bet we could find more, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I have a CD that you gave me. I want to play...
Okay.
Something from it. Let's do that, and then we'll have one more break here, and then we'll have our last segment, okay?
I think it's track 4. It's a song called Icarus.
All right, and tell people a little bit about... I'm sure most people don't think of you as a musician particularly.
Oh, this isn't my music.
Oh, I thought it was, actually.
No, I've... this is just a really...
Because I know you play a little bit.
Yeah, I've got another disc we might play something off of, but this is just a neat song.
All right. Everybody, do you know who the band is?
I don't.
No, we'll listen to it anyway, and it's called Icarus. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan, and my guest is John Major Jenkins in the studio with me here tonight, along with my friend Ian and Bart. And we're having a fun and interesting conversation, as we always do. We'll listen to this song. We'll come back and do some more. Okay, it's Mike. Back with you in just a few minutes.
What's the man of science working? Twist and torture life, just a sect he never carried. Use his jungle like a knife. See the social planners planning how to bend us to the mold. For our own good, they'll direct us. Is control. Because your wings are melting, never will you reach the sun. If you feel your spirit soaring, your purpose shall come undone. Your purpose shall come undone. See the test tube babies forming. All alike in even rows. Mutant robots in the making. Number tags upon their toes. Old addictive trans convenience. See them catalog our lives. Their computer giants ticking. Control our lives. Because your wings are melting, never will you reach the sun. When you feel your spirit soaring, your problems shall come undone. Your problems shall come undone. Never.
Everybody, that's a song that's called Icarus, and interesting stuff coming in the audio waves from Bartholomew Bean tonight, and an unknown artist there, but another very good song. And John, I've got somebody calling, and we've been sort of jumping all around. Do you mind taking a phone call?
No, not at all.
Let's see what's going on here. Oh my gosh, they just hung up. So if you were trying to give us a call, go ahead and call back, and I'll pick that up when you do, okay? All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, on the web at kopn.org. My guest is John Major Jenkins. Once again, his website is alignment2012.com, and you can link over there from my site, as always. And, John, let's talk for a bit about I want to talk again about the sacredness of the word sacred. And we'll do that after we take this phone call, all right?
Okay.
Welcome to Radio Orbit. Hi, who's this?
Hi, this is Deborah. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, hi, Deborah. For once, I actually saw the phone ringing and picked it up.
Yeah, this is about the fifth time. I had wanted to ask him two things or to say something. First, long ways back about the I Ching and as above, so below, that's written on the cards. So, you know, for people who don't make that connection with the eight and the I Ching and all of that, as above, so below must evidently originate with that. And also I wanted to ask him if he knows who this Drinwala Melchizedek.
Drumvalo Melchizedek. I'm familiar with that guy's name. I've never talked to him, but I
had this book several years back, and he was going on the Old Testament, which was going along with my research and my findings. And then I had my MS and my stroke and stuff, and I can't find the book. It was a little blue paperback. But I have found this other book that's called Serpent of Light Beyond 2012. So when John started talking about the serpent, it just clicked in my head. So I wanted to ask him if he knows about this. This guy says this is about the process of Mother Earth's kundalini energy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
The rise of the
yeah.
divine feminine that moves across the surface of our world, which started in, goes from 1949 to 2013. It's called the Serpent of Light, and it's moved to the Andes Mountains of Chile and Peru. So I just thought, wow.
That is amazing.
There's a connection
yeah.
here.
All right. Thank you, Deborah.
Yeah, thanks, Deborah.
We'll let John answer you, okay?
I think that you're referring to the Flower of Life work that Drinwala Melchizedek has been involved in. He accesses some pretty interesting information around the sacred science principles and also provides teachings for how one can transform the consciousness through, if I have it correct, utilizing the Flower of Life, which is this kind of geometrical, sacred geometry kind
right.
of image that one can gaze upon. It's kind of a meditative.
That's what I've been following for years and years.
Yeah.
And it's taken me to all cultures and deeply into the Bible. The twins are in the, you know, Ephesus and the origin of the Hebrew, the whole thing, it's in there.
Beautiful, yeah.
And so it's taken me. It's that symbol from Inanna. It goes everywhere. The truth and justice wheel and the Dharma wheel, the Egyptian goddess wheel, things like that. So, yeah, I've been following that flower.
Oh, that's amazing. And then it does get to that teaching about the kundalini, the serpent energy that, you know, rises up and integrates the polarities.
Well,
do you know, is this the same Melchizedek that is researching the Old Testament astronomical references?
That I don't know.
I don't know either.
Oh, I wish I could find that book, but I've misplaced it somewhere. And it's a very small little book, and it's very dense. Hard to pay attention to. But thank you very much.
All right, Deborah, thanks so much for calling.
Mm-hmm.
Take care. Again, the word sacred came up in our conversation there with Deborah.
Hmm.
It keeps coming up. And I think that we've made a number of references tonight, John, to our own culture and then looking back at some of these other ones. And one of the things that seems to be not present here, at least nowhere near to the level that it was in the past, is this idea of anything being sacred. The word sacred, I think, is not even very well understood by most people in our culture. I don't think that they really grasp the seriousness of the word. But the Maya and others apparently approach the whole world like that, in a sacred manner.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And is that something that is required in order to understand this stuff?
Well, I think it's helpful because it gives a true vision of the way that the world really is. I mean, when people do have an initiatory experience and they come back from that and they say, oh, I looked around me and I realized that everything is sacred. So notice that it's not, notice that it's a real, it's of a nature of a realization of the way that things really are. And it implies that when we are in a different state of consciousness, when we're not open to that, to seeing that, we are simply closed to something that is really there all the time. So I think that it is important to have that as kind of a basic operating system in one's life, even if one is not in that ecstatic state of consciousness all the time, to have one's life informed by the knowledge, not faith or belief, but the knowledge that everything is sacred, is really an important sort of requirement for then. It's just, you know, basically then defines all kinds of relations that you would have.
Right.
You know, treating people with respect and recognizing that all beings are a reflection of the same, creation.
We're getting close to 2012. It's 2008. I remember 1999, the rollover to the year 2000. I remember thinking then, wow, we're only 12 years away. Now we're only 4 years away, four and some change, right? There, for me as an individual, I've been observing the world and trying to make sense of it like anybody does, but I've for the longest time had the 2012 thing sort of hanging back there in the back of my head and trying to observe the world with the knowledge that there are some people and certainly well thought out arguments that say that something is happening and that whether it happens on that, you know, that immediate date, time, etc., or whether it's just a time frame like we're talking about, we are getting close. So I guess I'd like to ask you about what's your impression of just what's happening in the real world, and you know, where do you see things now, and are you seeing what you thought you might see?
Well, I guess I didn't really have any
preconceptions
really about, I'm always kind of an observer, but what I see going on in the world today is a direct, you might say that the Maya predicted it in a sense, you know, in the sense that the Maya understood how cycles work, and in their creation mythology, they basically have a story about how the vain and false ruler appears at the end of the cycle. We are at the end of the cycle right now. And his name is Seven Macaw. He's basically the archetype of vain, narcissistic egoism.
Is he a trickster, too, though?
No, he's not really a trickster.
Okay, all right. So he's just sort of a badass.
Yeah, he's just totally self-consumed and does not recognize any authority above his own egoic self and so on. This is a pretty typical situation of a consciousness that is disconnected from its essence. It doesn't recognize that there's a, you know, a higher source or anything like that. It's kind of the state of the world that we live in today.
Right. Materialist, reductionist, scientist, all of these isms that we talk about.
Yeah. And so I kind of see the situation in the world today as somewhat predictable, generally speaking. These are, of course, all generalities. But I don't know. It's a difficult thing to really talk about. I guess my feeling is that the modern world is in a crisis, and it's a crisis of disconnect. The crisis is caused by the disconnect. The disconnect between, I don't know, there's many ways you can say it. I guess we're in a fragmented state of consciousness. We don't see the whole picture. Mm-hmm. And that's why we do things, or our institutions, or our culture, or our civilization do things that don't make any sense, mm-hmm. you know, like pouring pollution into rivers, or, you know, we're not seeing the connections between our behaviors and the results of our behaviors, and so these crazy things are happening.
This town that we're in right now, right, Columbia, Missouri, you can't smoke a cigarette in a bar, even though people smoke a few or whatever, but the law says you can't. They're trying to protect everybody from smoking cigarettes, right? But we've got two coal-fired power plants that are pumping filth into the sky 24/7. Half the children have asthma.
Oh, wow.
You know?
Wow.
I mean, we're polluting the soil, the earth, the water, the air, and we've been doing so pretty much nonstop for at least 100 years since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So I certainly see a disconnect there like you're talking about. It's cognitive dissonance. It's so weird.
Yeah, and I don't know exactly what the solution is unless it's going to be some kind of spiritually motivated social activism and inventive, innovative solutions to, or I wouldn't say solutions, but transformations of existing institutions and ways of doing things. We have to apply consciousness mm-hmm. to the situation.
The idea of the unconscious mind, that we actually have a segment or a part of our mind that is unconscious. We talk about it all the time. Oh, it's in my unconscious, you know, when you go to sleep or whatever. If people were fully conscious, in other words, if you eliminated the part of the mind that was unconscious, then you would sort of by definition have a person who was fully conscious. And I think back to Terence, who years ago said, you know, if a man whacks himself on the head with a ball-peen hammer, he will stop doing it immediately because the feedback loop is very short.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? And you feel the pain right away. We seem to have a similar situation going on in the planet, but we don't feel the hammer yet.
Well, five generations from now are going to be feeling it.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably one of the problems, is that, you know, and I think what needs to happen is that we need to revise our institutions. You know, it's not that we have to stay in some kind of, like, ultimate state of consciousness all the time,
mm-hmm.
but our institutions should be informed by the gnosis or the knowledge that is gathered in those states.
Right.
As it is now, our institutions are basically defined by the lowest common denominator, profit motive kind of things, and our policies are defined by trying to, you know, reach the largest number of people and say a school testing system, you know, so it's a smearing out onto the lowest common denominator.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's kind of a sad situation in that regards, because everything's flipped upside down. We should be actually striving for the highest.
Right,
you know?
Right. It really is upside down, but it's also approaching critical. In other words, all of our institutions, and I mean, I can't think of one that's actually doing really any good for anybody. Business mm-hmm. isn't, government doesn't seem to be, religion, institutionalized religion,
right.
I mean, you know, all of these things, healthcare, education, I mean, name an institution that's actually doing...
Well, this is where the, like, so-called common people, I guess, we're like a bunch of people on a bus, and nobody's driving the bus anymore, you know, and...
Is it the physical representation of seven macaw?
Yeah, basically. It is basically that situation. Seven macaw is running the world, in a sense. It's the seven macaw system,
huh.
where you have
be a good name
self-serving
for
leaders in high places. Also, the main institution that is ruling and ruining the world is the Institute of the Corporation. The corporation is like a narcissistic, self-serving, greedy, bottomless pit of hunger for more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a some kind of chain hardware store. I can't even remember the name of it, probably out of business or something. But their motto that you'd see on the side of their stores was, "More of everything." More of everything. I thought about that. I actually, it's a little epigram for my book, Galactic Alignment, because I dedicated the Galactic Alignment book to, said something like, this book is dedicated to all those who know that to seek more of everything is to have less than nothing. More of everything is an absurdity. It's an absurd construction. How could you have more of everything? But that is the rally cry for corporate, motivations and strategies.
You remind me of, there's a company called Sherwin-Williams that makes paint. You probably see it.
Mm-hmm.
I went to go get a bagel a couple mornings ago, and there's a Sherwin-Williams store right next to the place where I get my bagel. And their logo, I've seen it 1,000 times, but it really hit me, for the first time a couple days ago.
The world.
It's a picture of the Earth, the globe, and it has red paint.
Oh,
red
great.
Red paint that is dripping literally over the globe. And so the top 3/4 of the globe is red. The bottom of the globe is still blue and green like it would be, right? But there's paint dripping down. It's almost like a macabre Halloween blood dripping thing. And the tagline that they put under their logo is "Cover the World."
Oh, great!
I had the same epiphany not too long
Freaked
ago.
Freaked me out. I mean, I was like, that's one of the creepiest logos I've ever seen.
Do they even know what they're doing?
I mean, I'm thinking these marketing people. Somebody said, "Yeah, that's a great idea. Let's put that on every one of our stores." And then people go, and they're the biggest paint distributor in the
country. Wow. Right? Wow.
Well, can I
please
interject here?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Speaking of more of everything, this is something I wanted to bring up. As we get closer and closer to 2012, and I see it on the bookshelves daily, there's more and more of the 2012. There's
right.
Armageddon 2012.
Mm, oh, yeah.
Daniel Pinchbeck's now incarnating
Quetzalcoatl.
So, you don't have to name any names, but I'm just I'm wondering how you feel about all of this, because what I appreciate about your work is you constantly bring it back to the foundations, which is, the Mayan culture, the Mayan long calendar.
Right.
And everybody else seems to have their own opinion now.
Yeah.
About 2012.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Ian. I mean, certainly there's the whole spectrum of manifestations happening with 2012 in the marketplace. It's to be expected because it's such a hot button topic that plays into the mass media's favorite byline, which is "if it bleeds, it leads." And so you do get a full spectrum of things, and it's not surprising to see in the marketplace a lot of things that are simply designed in some kind of formulaic way to be a bestseller or something like that, and it's got all the requisite, sort of expected things, around doomsday and so on. Another thing that I see happening too, which is particularly sort of frustrating for me, having been involved in this for so many years, is as the 2012 meme gains popularity, there's an interest in having experts comment on it, So you have experts or so-called experts being pulled together, and maybe they're a recognizable name in the marketplace, and so that's, let's get them to say something about it, And then when they actually put something down on paper, a lot of times what I notice, it's just that so-called expert, maybe they've been talking about, the consciousness movement for a number of years, and they have their own sort of little rap on it or something, their recognizable trademarked rap. Well, they'll write something, but they'll take their trademark rap, and then they'll just sort of strategically insert 2012 into it in a couple of places. You see how that's kind of tricky? It's like now they're 2012 experts all of a sudden. So that can be pretty frustrating to see that happen. I think just on the level of what I see happening a lot is within the New Age community, you have sort of human potential ideas around being spiritual or transformation or whatever. And it's just assumed that 2012 is about that. So already existing wraps on transformation and spirituality can just be sort of glommed on to the 2012 discussion. But there's, for some strange reason, reference to the Maya is often completely lacking. And so it's strange to me because I don't want to think that I'm alone in thinking that we should try to plug into the Mayan wisdom about 2012. And if we're going to do that, then we need to ask the right questions, which I feel like I've done, you know, since the early 90s. One of the questions is, where was the long count calendar invented? I guess the bottom line is that we can actually access the authentic original Mayan wisdom for 2012 at the site of Azapa. It also is congruent with the Maya creation mythology, and that contains a prophecy for 2012 as well as a spiritual teaching, and this incredible galactic cosmovision that's integrated on the level of astronomy. So it's the whole package right there, and it's unique to the Maya insight.
All right. Fair enough, Ian?
Fair enough.
Okay. Bart, you got anything you want to ask, Sean? Yep, you're on. You're on, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Get nice and close, though.
Is it the Frank Waters write the book on the Hopi?
Yeah, Book of the Hopi, yeah.
And I seem to recall in that book, the one thing that kind of stuck to my soul was the story, the oral tradition of their telling of the end of one of their worlds where they just happened to notice that the sun rose in the west for a few days, and then, you know,
yeah.
And if you look at it, you know, if the earth topples, it would do that, and then it toppled again and started rising in the east again, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I love that book. Frank Waters was a great inspiration for me. The Book of the Hopi.
Mexico Mystique, right?
Mexico Mystique was great, but a lot of his other stuff is great. Masked Gods is another one. In fact, he was a novelist too, and this little book that he wrote is really a classic. The Man Who Killed the Deer. It's an amazing little novel. But anyway, I think of these indigenous oral tradition stories as being sort of metaphorical, and the way that I would understand the idea that the sun comes up in the west is basically the idea that everything's going to get inverted. And one way that I like to sort of apply this to the situation in the modern world is I like the work of social historian Rhianne Eisler in her book The Chalice and the Blade.
Sure. She's been on the program. You know that?
Oh yes. I listened to that.
She's wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah, she's great. And she has this model of two basically different styles of human culture. One is called the dominator mode, and that's really typifies our civilization. And the other alternative is the partnership mode. I like her use of these terms because it degenderizes the whole discussion. It's not about patriarchy versus matriarchy or something like that. Although there can be seen to be some gender connections in these things. Dominator mode is about territorialism and warfare and raping and pillaging and taking resources and not seeing the whole picture. The partnership mode is the mode that most of humanity has followed since the dawn of humanity. It's only in the recent 5 or 6 thousand years that the dominator mode has taken over.
Mm-hmm.
So what I think this inversion or this flipping around of the axis, all this kind of talk, I don't know what can even be said. Let's say the earth was going to flip on its axis. What can we do about it? We're dead. We're toast. But maybe these literal interpretations are really just hiding more metaphorical things that are just as real. It should be stressed that, you know, the metaphorical doesn't mean not real.
Right, right.
You know, literal means real, metaphorical means not real. That's not the way it works. Metaphorical, I think of as being sort of like the deeper substrate that lies behind the way that things manifest in the physical world.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could look at it as somewhat of a cosmic roller coaster ride.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the truth is that it's probably a little bit of both. You know, there's the physical world manifestation of things, and then there's the spiritual domain. But I would like to see a pole shift in our collective consciousness.
Yeah.
Away from the dominator mode towards the partnership
mode. Yeah.
Just speaking of just random factoid that I heard one time was there was a study of people having out-of-body experiences. And apparently when they were going through this, their polarity flipped. And which makes me think that, is there a pole shift? Does this create a mass out-of-body experience?
Huh.
That could be the great collective initiation at the end of the cycle.
Perhaps.
Even if for a glimpse.
Yeah, you know, I think about what Bart was saying before, you know, that people recognized that the sun was no longer first seen in the east, but in the west, which would indicate that a flip-flop had occurred.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if it were anything that happened even reasonably quickly, there would be many more things on their plate than worrying about where the sun was. In other words, you know, if something like that happens, it's lights out for everybody.
Your hard drive,
everything.
Done.
I mean, your body, everything. In other words, our brain, not to mention the physical.
They just might have noticed it between the storms and stuff.
Well, I mean, I don't think that there would be anyone left to notice anything. In other words, if the poles shift in a physical sense quickly, and by quickly I mean over the course of a few days, right? In other words, if the planet went from North Pole here, pointing toward Polaris, to 5 days later, a week later, a month later, to now the South Pole pointing at Polaris, you would have cataclysms on this planet where no one would survive, I don't think. The water alone would wash over everything. It'd be like a big bathtub that just whoosh, and
enough to like cover up a big city outside of Bombay.
I'm sure, yeah.
And you would hope that you had a mass out-of-body experience at that point.
And maybe that's something like that. You know, we've been talking about fractals all night and this above, as above, so below idea and all that. Well, in Gaian theory, you know, people that talk about the Earth as
living organism,
sentient creature, well, then she has her own evolutionary agenda, you know, as well. And are we a part of that? It seems we are. I mean, we seem to be a pretty significant force among animals, at least, on the planet. But, I mean,
sounds like it would be a good time to be a part of the solution.
No pun intended.
If you're not, you would be a part of the problem. Therefore, you might not be needed anymore.
Well, I mean, this is the scary side of all this: is that you know, all of the, not all, but you know, many people who are you know, leaders in their fields, regardless of the area of endeavor, many people are saying that the Earth is beyond her sustaining capacity for us, and that there are just too many humans, and that a major reduction in population is going to be either it's just going to happen, you know, or it's going to be required.
And there are those who believe that, as you know, Mike, I've been enlightened with your research into these questions of overpopulation and population control. There are those who believe that
they're the ones to decide.
Yeah,
they think they can decide who's going to stay and who's going to go. But I think that's a really naive position. In other words, I've always been, anyone who knows me knows that I laugh at the powers that be. I mean, I you see, I mean, I fool with them. I send them all these letters. I don't care at all. I tell them I grow my own mushrooms in my basement, and I live in Roachport, and you all know where I live, and you listen to my phone calls, and, you know, and I grow cannabis down by my lake, and I love it, and I love my plants. And there's no such thing as an illegal plant, you know? There's no such thing as an illegal animal, right? I've always thought that they were just buffoons. And usually when they try to do something, they will mess it up. The whole HIV/AIDS thing, you know, it was very ill-intended. But it still didn't work. The planet is still way overpopulated. It killed millions of people. But that's nothing. I mean, they're talking about eliminating billions of people if we're going to get back to what Lovelock and other people say is sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just somebody's opinion. And okay, my opinion is that the Earth can sustain 10 billion people. No problem. That's my opinion. And my opinion is as good as theirs, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
So mindset has such a huge, plays such a big role in how we bring about the future. You mentioned earlier that it's participatory, right? That we are a part of this. Whatever's coming, you better damn right realize you're a part of it, and your actions will affect it. Maybe significantly, maybe not, but they will affect it. You know,
maybe there's don't mean to interrupt.
No, go.
Like maybe there is something akin to the 100th monkey phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And the population increase is sort of part of a spilling over process for consciousness that the Earth is actually doing towards an end or for a purpose.
Yeah.
And to artificially reduce population, it's actually sort of aborting the process by which we can sort of spill over to the next level of organization,
right,
you know,
of
like social organization and
right,
so on. You know,
right.
I mean, it's a pressure driven sort of process,
mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm,
life kind of is that way.
Yeah, it really is, and certainly with monkeys, you know, the monkeys don't like to get busy until things get really hot. I mean, we tend to be the most procrastinative of any species I've ever seen.
And by the way, they did new studies on that. It's actually not 100 monkeys. It's 98 monkeys. They just released a new study on
that. Are you being serious?
No, I'm just
kidding. Oh, my God.
98.2 monkeys.
Well, it would be interesting if that was actually the case, if there was a threshold number or percentage of human beings or any population of critters that when a certain number of them reached...
But it's 72 orangutans.
Yeah. So now,
12 elephants.
Yeah. One ant. Right? I mean, that's the butterfly effect. Right? And you and I were talking about butterflies earlier today. And maybe this is good. We got a few more minutes. But let's talk about this. And I want you to read a poem before we go.
Oh, okay.
But I mentioned to you that when John Sheliak was on talking to me on the phone a few weeks ago, we were talking about transformation.
And, oh, yeah, I love right, that, yeah.
Yeah, and he used the butterfly caterpillar, or the caterpillar to butterfly example as a fundamental, obvious case of transformation. And he talked about how when a butterfly comes out of a cocoon, it's not just a caterpillar that grew wings. It's a caterpillar that was dissolved, literally dissolved into an aqueous fluid, and then that fluid reassembles itself into the likes of this butterfly. And there are two things that I thought were really interesting when he talked about this. The first was that the cells that initialize the change are called imaginal cells.
Imaginal cells.
This is in the scientific literature, right?
Yeah.
They call these cells imaginal cells, and they're the ones that start to reorganize the caterpillar and eventually kill the caterpillar for all practical purposes, and then build the butterfly. But I think the most stunning part about it was that the caterpillar didn't realize it was going to become a butterfly, most likely, because the caterpillar's own immune system is attacking the imaginal cells and everything that's trying to break it down. And you made the great analogy today about how the control mechanisms of our culture and our society are essentially that immune system.
Mm-hmm.
And we might, you know, God willing, think of ourselves as imaginal cells, you know, people, individuals, not necessarily just monkeys, plants, mushrooms,
mm-hmm.
you know, bears, who knows. But if we can imagine them as imaginal cells, cells that are pushing towards a new reformation, a transformation, but yet those cells, that's why we all feel so alienated. Guys like us, girls like us that are pushing against the status quo and against that which came before, because the immune system of the paradigm is working to try to rid itself of us.
Progress is a threat to the status quo.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Amazing. Well, yes. John Major Jenkins, my brother, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm so glad to be here. This is really amazing for me.
Well, it's a thrill and a privilege and a pleasure to talk to you every time
we had
a chance
about 3 more hours.
I do too. Unfortunately, we don't. And I got to work at 8 in the morning, and I got to get rid of this cold between now and then. But I want to say thank you to Ian and to Bart as well for bringing us some great conversation and music. And we will close out the program in a sort of unique and new fashion for me. I usually play a song, but tonight we're going to have John read a piece of his poetry. And Ruth isn't even here yet, so you read anything you like, and then I'll throw on some music, and we'll say goodbye to everybody. Before we do that, though, alignment2012.com, also Los Angeles.
Los Angeles Conference. People should go to my website. There's a one-day conference happening March 1st in Hollywood, Los Angeles. And there's going to be a lot of speakers there, myself, Alberto Valoldo, mm-hmm. Daniel Pinchbeck, Jay Widener, Sharon Rose, several other very interesting speakers. And it should be an interesting day. So if you're out on the West Coast, check that out.
I think Ian might be there. Huh?
Yes,
I will
That's
be
great.
There.
All right.
And there are a couple people in the chat said they're going to be there. So, all right. Well, also, last thing, tomorrow night at the Blue Fugue, 7 o'clock, me and John will be there, Ian will be there, Bart will be there, I'm sure, and a whole bunch of other folks, and you're welcome to come down and join us. It should be a great time and really informative as well. So with that, I will bid you all adieu and say thanks again to everybody and to John.
All right.
Let's hear a piece of something you've written.
Well, these are a long series of poems that I wrote when I went to the temples of Maya land mm-hmm. about a year ago, and I wrote them and put them together into a booklet called A Wandering Scholar's Triptychon, 44 Sonnets from the Mayan Temples. The Stones of Palenque. The crystal stones of old Palenque transfix Muladhara. Mystify moods in the chamber of moon. Of a sudden, a sun ray alights on a rune that the Maya translated from Stella Mara. Starlight on stone through tropic air, stairway into cloud. Altars offer the solar essence. The visages stare, preserve a presence of beings whose minds were well endowed. Flesh and blood are bending stones, twisting them around. Knotted trees make solar cages, entomb the bones of ancient sages whose eyes are hanging upside down. The palace cathedral of Yaxchilan, altars everywhere. Jaguar, monkeys, and rivers roar. Out beyond the other shore, this city of stars is forever there. In the cleft of the tree at river's end, emerald green recycles emergence's endless parade as the temporal bend reveals the charade. We slip to shadows in the land in between. Jaguar shield encased in rock, supine crocodile, rises aloft to make the sky high. The celestial clock teaches us why all of our efforts get heaped in a pile. God pots broken on the pyre, feeding cosmic roots, murals and sculptures of lotus-eyed yogis fanning the fire with smoked water lilies, tasting the bliss of ambrosial fruits. Swallowed for eons by the Lacandon, forest of rain, tendrils are splitting the stairway's ascent, decaying the stone with tireless intent, showing the power of spirit's domain. Devil's Palace at Ashkintok, an open door. Words came through, speaking clear. Sun-stroked rock dissolved my fear, immersed us in the ancient lore. Winged angel faces south, stony eyes cry. Ekbalam has fanged teeth and gaping mouth, where underneath a butterfly is winging by.
Aho. KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You've been listening to Radio Orbit. Thanks to all of you. Can't wait to do it again.